Good morning. Welcome. We are reconvening this meeting, this 113th meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. This morning, we have a number of important topics that we'll be covering, in particular related to seismic hazard at the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant, continuing from discussion that we had yesterday evening. And so I'll be starting that up in just a moment. We're starting a little bit early also because we're going to be ending up this public meeting at approximately 11:30 this morning. And then we'll have members of the public coming here to Avila Lighthouse Suites. We'll be registering them in and conducting the first public tour that the committee has had since before the pandemic. Looking forward to that enormously, the opportunity to meet and talk with people who are interested in the plant and learn about what their thoughts and concerns are has in the past been enormously productive. And furthermore, it's just kind of fun to get on a bus with a bunch of people and go travel around and see stuff that's interesting. So with that, let's go ahead and convene the meeting. We will have a public comment period on matters not on the agenda at the end of the meeting this time. That's how it's indicated on the agenda, which means that after I ask for any committee member or consultant remarks or comments, then we'll dive into our first agenda item. Do we have any?
No, just I want to say good morning to you, good morning to my colleagues on the table, and good morning to the audience online and in the room. Thank you very much, Dr. Peters.
Yes, and it's people know we've been getting quite a bit of rain coming through, but I'm looking out the windows and seeing some sunshine, so I'm crossing my fingers that it's going to be a great afternoon today. Okay, very good. So the first item that we have on our agenda is informational items before the committee, and in particular, we have discussion, direction, actions as appropriate by the committee, consultants, and council. And in particular, we are going to receive and discuss PG&E's response as supplemented to the DCISC 35th Annual Report on the Safety of the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant Operations. And this is going to include discussion of DCISC's seismic review teams, of PG&E's response as supplemented to recommendations 1 through 9 from the seismic review team. So the first thing I believe is that we do have a presentation related to the recommendations, and I would ask Tom Jordan, our consultant, and I believe we have, do we have online also the other members of our seismic review team? Yes. Thank you, Scott. Mike, okay, let's go ahead and dive in. And I should note we also have some of our seismic experts from PG&E here as well as other experts. So, Tom, please.
Thank you, Per. So I'm going to basically react, give our SRT's response to the presentation we heard last evening by Chris Magudo. And I would like to, the other two SRT members, Mike Oskin and Scott Marshall, are on Zoom, and we will be trading back and forth and making our comments. So let me begin with just a summary of the timeline of SRT activities over the last year. We were constituted at this meeting, the February meeting last year, and were charged with reviewing documents that Dr. Peter Byrd of UCLA had submitted to DCISC and NRC regarding the thrust fault hazard beneath the beneath the Irish Hills. And so we conducted that review and presented it at the June meeting. And contained within that review were 9 recommendations for PG&E that they might use to improve their understanding of the problems that were being discussed in this controversy and the Byrd critique. The SRT met with the PG&E staff in September to kind of go over those recommendations, make sure they understood what we were trying to say. And they presented a preliminary response at the October meeting. That preliminary response was also put into the DCISC 35th annual report. It's very short; it's only about a paragraph. So DCISC responded to that by requesting a supplemental information, and that supplemental information request shown here. They asked that PG&E respond with additional information that would allow us, the SRT, to evaluate the technical adequacy of that response. And we asked that they respond to each recommendation individually, and in particular as to whether they agreed with the recommendation, agreed that there needed to be action on the recommendation. If they did think there needed to be action, we asked them to summarize what that might be, the time scale involved, and the priority given to it. And then finally, to evaluate which recommendations have the potential to make a significant impact on hazard. And in our formulation of significant impact, we not only a matter of how much it might change the hazard, but also how much it might reduce the epistemic uncertainties associated with the hazard and validate the current models. So PG&E responded about a week ago with a supplementary report, and this is just some words taken from that report. And of course, Chris last night expanded on this. Basically, they said that the priorities that they give to this work is sort of medium, and that a lot of the research that will be necessary to address these recommendations will take several years or so. And in terms of the priority, the medium importance that they give to this, that is because there are other issues, such as the slip rate on the Hawsbury Fault, the time dependence of that fault, and projects related to ground motion modeling that have higher priority, because they, based on an epistemic uncertainty analysis, they would argue that those have larger uncertainties. Now, PG&E did provide individual responses to each of the nine recommendations, and we heard those from Chris last night. Here's a matrix similar.
Tom, could we go back to the previous slide for just a second? I think maybe this is a good point to discuss the scope of the SRT's review, which was limited to the bird concerns and the bird critique, and therefore did not relate to other parts of the seismic hazard at the plant directly, such as the Hawsbury Fault. Could you discuss that point a little bit? Because I think it's
very important context here. Yeah, our charge was to address the bird critique, and that critique was focused on thrust faulting beneath the Irish Hills. Mm-hmm. So in bird's critique and also in our response to that critique, the Hawsbury Fault was not discussed extensively. We did talk about it in terms of its effect in terms of geodetic signals and so forth, but we have not looked at the detailed information on, for example, slip rate of the Hawsbury Fault. We know that's a controversial subject, mm-hmm. but we did not examine that.
Yeah. And of course, the context is that to the degree that the Hawsbury dominates the actual hazard, then it's reasonable to want to focus significant effort onto it. At the same time, there's value in looking at these additional areas that the seismic review team has identified. Is that sort of a correct interpretation?
I think that's correct, absolutely. So, yeah, we recognize, in fact, when we put forward these recommendations, we did not try to prioritize those recommendations because the recommendations have to be prioritized in the context of the other issues that are seismic issues that are faced, and so we were pretty careful to make sure that we understood that PG&E would not be putting these at highest priority. We did not expect that.
Very good, thank you.
Okay, so here's a matrix similar to the one that Chris showed last night. This is one we constructed from that report. The very similar sort of commentary here. There is the last column on this matrix shows potential hazard impact. And here, this shows our evaluation rather than PG&E's. And again, in terms of assessing impact, we think it's not just the information that would change the value of the hazard, but also information that would reduce the uncertainties on those values and would validate the hazard models. So what we're going to do is go through each of these recommendations. The first four focus on fault system modeling, and Mike Oskin is going to give commentary on each of those four recommendations. The next four regard geodetic modeling, and Scott Marshall will comment on those. And then finally, I'll comment on the SSC modeling that constitutes the ninth recommendation. So let me turn it over to Mike Oskin.
Good morning. Okay, so this is our, we looked closely at everything that was proposed to address the nine recommendations. And on recommendation one, this is the recommendation to build a set of kinematically constrained models for reverse faults that underlie the Irish Hills. This is the recommendation that addresses that PG&E should look closely at the geometry of those faults that do trend underneath the plant. So there was some comments, public comments yesterday that was not part of our recommendations, but this might be a little bit coded for the specifics, but this is the recommendation that addresses that. Our comments on PG&E's response is that it is a good idea to use the outcrop exposure along the Irish Hills and to the east because they expose different structural depths within the deformed Pismo Basin, so that's useful. So we do endorse additional research on the eastern Pismo Basin where there's more abundant subsurface data and the opportunities to use these crossing streams and stream terraces as deformation markers. That makes sense in addition to using the data closer to the plant that's available from surface mapping. And we also want to encourage continued work in understanding Morro Bay subsidence and tilting of the Memorial Terrace. And this comes to perhaps a point of confusion. In the report, we specified examining this problem as it pertains to understanding the geometry of the southwest boundary zone, because if there is uplift being masked by localized subsidence of Morro Bay for another reason, understanding that uplift signal is important for getting at the deeper geometry of the fault and whether it goes to a horizontal flat or to a more inclined ramp. So as they develop the fault geometry models to be tested, those elements need to be included. Next slide. Okay, so the second recommendation.
Oh, Mike, apologies. Could we go back one? I have a quick question.
Yes.
So I think one of the key things here is that PG&E has noted that this is probably a 3-year timeline to address this recommendation. I want to check first. I assume that given the scope of the work, that's a reasonable estimate of how long it could take?
To develop, to further refine the fault geometry model, yes, it is of that kind of time frame. That'll take some synthesis of data and construction of models and testing of models against the geology.
Yeah,
so that's reasonable.
Good. And so the thing that I would note is that there is a concurrence between SRT and PG&E that is embedded in this response to the recommendation, with the important point being that this will take nominally about 3 years to perform this scope of work. And I think I'm prepared to agree also that this looks like it's reasonable based on the advice and such. Which in turn means that we need to flag the DCISC is going to need to monitor over this next 3 years progress in this area so that we can confirm that it's being addressed correctly and such. And maybe at the end of the discussion, we'll have some committee discussion about how it is that we will monitor the progress on PG&E's efforts to address these recommendations. Noting that it's not something that happens like in a week or two, it will be something that will be worked on over the coming 3 years, and probably I would say has to be embedded in the committee's ongoing efforts to monitor progress around better understanding of seismic hazard, and particularly the work of the IPRP that is addressing that. Does that make sense to others on the committee?
Yes, and I think it's very important to communicate those expectation of timelines.
Exactly. Yep. I mean, that's the reason that I'm really drilling into this point, that this is something that we expect to be addressed, but over this coming sort of three-year time frame is what's reasonable for that work to be done, and there's an expert consensus that that is a sufficient time frame, appropriate time frame to do the work.
Right, and that's the time frame for a number of these recommendations. So these are not problems that can be easily sort of addressed, you know, quickly. They do require extensive research and effort. And so the three-year timescale is sort of applies to the entire package, I would say.
So from the perspective of, the public, if the public is concerned, and this is a process that takes 3 years, then do we remain concerned for the duration of those 3 years? How do we think about this?
Well, you know, I think these are elements of concern, but the main concern that the SRT has addressed is really the concerns raised by the Byrd critique, and we think those concerns have been addressed, and that should provide the public with information so they can assess for themselves the Byrd critique. Now, these issues that we're talking about today are more long-term issues having to do with the development of the seismic source characterization model. And that, of course, is an ongoing project within PG&E, and they have their long-term seismic program that addresses that. And the timescales involved with addressing these recommendations are similar to those for other problems that are being addressed by the long-term seismic project.
Okay. And so based on the risk decisions are made today based on the models that we have, and then we'll be making maybe even better decisions with more developed models in the future, but at the moment it's responsible to be making decisions based on the models that we do have.
Yeah, I think an overall comment that's probably appropriate is that there's nothing in these recommendations that we see so far that is liable to significantly increase the hazard beyond its current values. There will be changes, and those changes, of course, should be documented and included. But there's nothing to sort of at the scale, for example, of the Byrd critique in terms of uncertainties or issues that would directly affect that hazard estimation.
So in lay terms, if improving this model won't likely increase the hazard, then why improve the model? What's the value of having a better model?
So I'm sorry, what is the value? So,
yes, if improving this model is not expected to increase the risk,
well, so
then what is the value?
One important thing to realize is that even though we talk about the hazard projections of a model like that, those projections are very uncertain. And so a lot of this work is really aimed at reducing those uncertainties, you know, coming up with better values, but also smaller uncertainties, and also to really ask the question about whether the current model can be validated using other kinds of data, such as geodetic data.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, Mike.
I think I might add that the lower geometry of this fault is important for understanding the seismic moment that it could produce. So, you know, these are, I concur with Tom, these are issues that they're going to adjust the hazard, but they're not something that is, these are medium concerns. This is for improving the model.
Now, you know, I'd also like to just make a higher level point, which is that the research on seismic hazard that's been conducted here at the plant site is, I would assume, expect some of the most detailed scientific investigation because of the complexity here that has occurred, and that there it's actually advanced our fundamental understanding and ability to model seismic hazards substantially, that's a social good. Our ability, because earthquakes can be enormously destructive, particularly in places where you don't correctly engineer structures and other things, and you have tragic things happen. And our ability to better predict and understand seismic hazards is a good thing. To the extent that PG&E is subsidizing that public good which is being generated is a benefit. This is also, I think, one of the reasons why the continued work to study these problems and refine our understanding and ability to predict is worthwhile. It's probably, you know, we've characterized this area sufficiently that we can really test our theories on a pretty complex. Well, okay. So see, we need more work. In any case, one
way to characterize it: this is a really well equipped natural laboratory for studying earthquake processes. And I think it's well recognized that there has been a huge amount of work done. So that the geology, the geophysics of these regions is understood as well as any area. And we would hope that making progress on understanding seismic hazard here would be translatable into other regions, especially regions of so-called transpression that are similar to this one.
So in terms of, communicating to, in lay terms, how we think about responsible management of the hazards that we have on hand, can you paint a picture of the alternative? So today we're responsibly managing the hazard of having the plant in this seismic area. What would be a scenario that wouldn't be responsible? In two ways. What would be a scenario where the risk were just not acceptable? And what would be a scenario where our understanding would be just too incomplete to be able to operate a plant in this region? Can you paint the alternative for the audience so that we understand in comparison where we are today?
So what we're talking about is seismic hazard. And right. Of course, in order to really address the issues the public is most concerned with, you have to translate that into seismic risk. Mm-hmm. And that's not the purpose of the hazard studies. The hazard studies want to get the best understanding, document the best understanding of the seismic hazards. But then you have to take that information and ask, what is the risk to the plant based on what we know in terms of the seismic hazard? And, of course, that's not something the SRT has done and does require other considerations besides the seismic hazard, lots of other factors, economic and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's out of scope to describe the risk. We can only describe the hazard. And how about in terms of knowledge completeness?
In terms of
knowledge completeness.
Right. Well, yes, there is a lot of knowledge, of course, of this area because of the extensive studies that have been made. But, the Earth is so complex and this region is tectonically so complex that there's still lots of missing information. I think one of the important recommendations that we have made at the SRT is to do more research using the geodetic data that's available that allows us to better understand the regional deformation that gives rise to earthquakes in this region. So there's a lot to be done.
Yeah. So how does one make a decision then about, so when we say more understanding always is needed, but there is, however, a threshold where we say our understanding is sufficiently complete that we can then manage this hazard.
That's the type of analysis that Chris last night alluded to with respect to what are called tornado diagrams, which are basically calculations of which factors are least understood that have an impact on the hazard. And so I think that kind of analysis is very appropriate for guiding where to put resources in terms of research on these topics.
And, of course, we also look at the question of risk, that is, how will the plant respond to the seismic inputs, And important to note is that there have been earthquakes that have shaken the plant. There is data. So basically, in some sense, the predictions for how the plant will respond have been validated by how the plant has responded to other types of earthquakes. And the plant was engineered to a very high ground motion level. And you find that when you go through the plant. The construction includes the gantry crane instead of a conventional polar crane to reduce the weight on the containment structure, and then large amounts of seismic bracing. The other part is that from the perspective of being able to mitigate any type of beyond design basis response, there's direct pathways from the earthquake response procedures to use flex equipment if needed. And the combination of those things does reduce the risk that an earthquake, even a large earthquake, could cause problems at the plant. And it's also important to emphasize that when we start to talk about that end of the probability spectrum in terms of earthquakes, the implications for the neighboring communities are actually pretty severe. One of the things we look at, the earthquake in Japan, and the plant just up north of Fukushima. Onagawa, important context for the people, because they responded very well, and the plant ended up in a safe state. They inundated the entire town, like 10-20% of the population perished. The people that were working at their plant were doing that in the context of what had happened to their families in the town. So when we start to talk about these really, really severe types of earthquakes, we need to recognize that it's not just the plant that we should be thinking about. And to the extent that we misdirect our attention from things, one of our motivations for caring about seismic safety in the workplace and bracing of furniture is for the workers, but it's also with the hope that they take that home with them, and they do the same thing in their homes, right? Because it really is important. I'm going to pause because I think we want to let you get through the rest of your presentation.
If I could add one more thought, I think this context is important. So we have that context that you described is important, and so we have an understanding of the hazard, and based on that hazard, we have a prediction of whether the seismic events in the region would exceed the design basis of the plant, and our understanding today is that they would not exceed it. And so it would not be responsible to say this plant can't operate here, because our current understanding is that this plant can operate here based on our current understanding of the hazard and our current design. So that would be the responsible decision to make. What we're saying is that continued understanding of the hazard is always valuable. It's part of the philosophy of how the nuclear industry functions. And so we're going to continue to develop the description of hazard and respond to it if new knowledge appears, or if it doesn't, then we continue on the course. And so I think that's the answer I find to the question of how do we make a responsible decision. There remains still the question of at what point do we consider the hazard description sufficiently complete? We can never prove completeness, but is it acceptably well understood?
Right. One thing that's important is that we don't make statements like some hazard level cannot be exceeded. In other words, that is not what we would say is that some hazard level is so high that it would be exceeded only very rarely. So there's always a time scale associated with these kinds of statements and a probability that's attached to them. Mm-hmm. So it's
Thank
all
you.
Probabilistic.
I stand corrected. Thank you. That correction is important.
Good.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, shall we continue?
Please.
Yeah. Mike, so, number two.
I'm going to...
Sorry.
pause for a moment here. I do have to leave at 9 o'clock sharp. So
okay, in that case, then let's cover your material.
All right. So I want to go through the other three recommendations on the geologic modeling. Recommendation two from the SRT was to date low stand abrasion platforms offshore that are submerged south of the Irish Hills to further constrain the rate of footwall subsidence. And this was not endorsed by PG&E, and we want to comment on that. The reason to do this is that footwall subsidence is important for understanding the complete rate of slip across the southwest boundary zone, which includes other faults that are a known offshore, the Luciano and Los Barros Fault, in addition to the onshore San Luis Bay Fault. The missing subsidence component, if it's important, could be indicated by the difference in the long-term rate we calculated from our fault model of 0.5 plus or minus 0.1 millimeters a year, and the rate we calculated from marine terrace uplift, which would not include the subsidence component of 0.29 plus or minus 0.07 millimeters per year. But we agree that direct dating of platforms is challenging, and that was not the intention of the recommendation. Stratigraphic constraints and understanding more about the abrasion platform history offshore from existing data would be sufficient. So that is, in my view, a sufficient attention to the problem, which is what they are going to do. Next slide. So recommendation three was to monitor IRSL dating efforts and reassess, if necessary, the age assignments for the marine terraces that fringe the Irish Hills. And these are key markers for the uplift rate and slip rate of the southwest boundary zone. And as summarized by Chris's talk yesterday, recently presented revisions to the IRSL results brings them into alignment with the dates for the Q1 and Q2 terraces. Known from new series dating of solitary corals. So this problem for those terraces is coming to a resolution that agrees with the current slip rate assessments. There is ongoing question of work to the south involving the Casmelia Hills thrust and the marker that gives a very high rate of slip on that fault, the Orcutt Formation. And I have been in conversations in how to advise new work to validate that age and also help to bring in other collaborators to work on that project. So that's a kind of a side topic here. But the main issue with this recommendation has been monitored and coming to a resolution. Next slide. And the SRT recommends further investigation of the potential for strike slip faulting along the Los Osos trend north of the Irish Hills and its impacts on marine terrace uplift. So this was endorsed by PG&E. I think there was, however, some confusion about our request versus the different pieces of how to address this problem. So we endorsed the renewed focus on the onshore and offshore evidence for strike slip faulting. This updated study and understanding whether there's strike slip will be important for understanding how the transpression is expressed across the range and the dip slip to strike slip partitioning and ratio of those. And then as I brought up a couple slides ago, understanding the Morro-based subsidence is not necessarily a target for getting a strike slip rate on the Los Osos fault. It is a way to clarify whether the lack of uplift and marine terraces in that area is important for understanding the deeper geometry of the southwest boundary zone. So it's still important to understand that uplift signal because as it pertains to that deeper part of the fault. That summarizes the components I'm going to discuss.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. So let's turn now to the four recommendations that are essentially directed towards geodetic modeling. And Scott Marshall's here to talk us through that.
Okay, hello. I should point out that the geodetic modeling, Tom commented on this, but there were some comments about do we sufficiently understand the hazard at the plant? And I think it's important for us to recognize that science is always changing, and how well we understand something back in the time of the 2015 SSC might be very different now. And so I think these geodetic recommendations fall under that umbrella because satellite geodesy has improved much in the last 10 or 11 years. So the three recommendations here are that the PG&E should follow up with a more complete study of available GPS data, that the fault slip models that underlie the SSC should be developed into kinematic and or mechanical models that can predict basically what the GPS sees and directly test it against this data, and that PG&E should look at quantifying the contributions of strike slip motion throughout the region in comparison to the reverse fault motion, which is something we tried to do in our SRT report. So PG&E endorses this. They agree that these are medium priority projects. And again, I think this is an example of something that is now can be better understood than it was 10 or 12 years ago when the original SSC was developed. So our comments on this is that there's a lot to be done here, but within a three-year time period, I think that most of this work can be completed, assuming that we leverage existing data sets instead of trying to create our own new data set from source data. For example, in our SRT report, we used the National Seismic Hazard Model data set, which is very nice, instead of processing our data from raw, satellite returns. We should probably follow the overall United States Geologic Survey National Seismic Hazard Model approach, where multiple models are solicited or created, because there's more than one mathematical method to simulate motions that are seen by satellites. And so the NSHM approach was that they solicited five different contributions. I'm not saying that we have to solicit five, but we should probably have more than one and compare the results between those different models. Mm-hmm. So this is an example of, the Diablo Canyon area has pushed forward seismic hazard assessments, as Per pointed out, but also we can leverage some of the ways that the USGS has also pushed seismic hazard assessments forward by using geodetic data. And then as PG&E's response was that they're interested in working with me on these, and I'm willing to participate in this work, but I should comment that I think we're going to need more than just me involved to be successful in these endeavors. Okay, next slide. And recommendation four.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Went the wrong way. There you go.
Okay. Recommendation eight. So this is the SRT recommendation that we essentially need more information about the Rinconada and Wasna faults. And Chris showed those on a map yesterday. Those are strike slip faults that are northeast of the plant. And we agree that these are far enough away from the plant that they don't directly pose a significant hazard to the plant. But as we showed in our SRT report, the effects of faults that are far away from the plant are significant in the region when you're looking at satellite data. And so it's important to be able to properly characterize these far away faults in order to know what's going on locally in the Irish Hills. And so PG&E agrees that these are now medium priority and essentially to help the geodetic modeling. And so we agree with this. And we also agree and recognize that identifying, mapping, and dating of these slip rate sites is complicated, and it's going to take several years to complete, and that literature review and site assessments are key, and that's a good first step for this recommendation. Okay, next, I think we're going to hand it back off to Tom.
All right, thank you, Scott. All right, so the last recommendation, sort of an overarching recommendation, that PG&E should do modeling experiments, calculations to ascertain the sensitivity of DCPP hazard to the modifications that the SRT has recommended to the SSC. So this has a high priority. In fact, PG&E has a very active project to develop what they call a sensitivity source model, or SSM, that would be the computational platform for conducting these sensitivity studies. And we applaud this development. The SSC model that currently applies to the plant is very complex, and it's unwieldy in terms of being able to do these kinds of detailed calculations. And so we think this is an important development, and we support that. We, of course, know these sensitivity analyses can be difficult to accomplish, and the reason is, although you might be looking at one particular model component and wanting to know the sensitivity of changing some aspect of that component, it often involves interactions with other model components, and so these studies are not trivial, and again, will probably take some time. Now, the current plan that PG&E has put forward is that this SSM this model will be available probably by mid-year, by June of this year, and they will then begin using this computational platform to test the sensitivity of the fault geometry models, in particular some of the recommendations that we made in our report regarding those models. And so we think that's a very good development, and we, of course, would like to hear more in terms of the technical details of how this is going to be done, and we'll monitor this as that research goes forward. So those are the nine recommendations. And, you know, in terms of a summary of how PG&E has done in terms of reacting to the DCISC request for supplemental information, we think that that response was quite adequate for us to be able to make a preliminary assessment of their plans. We think that they are going to be pushing forward a research program that we can endorse. PG&E has responded to each of our recommendations, and I think they agree that further action is warranted on all nine. On the second recommendation, they didn't much like that recommendation since they didn't really accept the recommendation as it was written. But they do outline research that would address the SRT issues that are raised in that context. So we have recommendations that are currently being addressed by the ongoing research program that they sponsor, and we have other recommendations where they will be developing or expanding research programs to attack those issues. Now, in terms of which of these recommendations have the potential to make significant impact, that's not yet understood, because you have to go through these sensitivity studies to really get a quantitative understanding of that. So that's information we expect will be developed again over the next couple of years. But there may be some low-hanging fruit. We may be able to get some progress as time scales as short as a year or so. So in summary, we felt that the PG&E response was adequate and sufficient for us to be able to understand their planned response and to evaluate that. We, of course, recognize that these recommendations are assigned a medium priority by PG&E, and the reason for that is that there are other issues, such as the Hosgery hazard, uncertainties in the ground motion models, and in particular, the time dependence of the earthquake process, in particular, the question of what is the date of the last event on the Hosgery fault, are very important issues that have perhaps a higher priority. I want to make one comment, it's a technical comment, about how the epistemic uncertainties are driving this problem. This comes back to these tornado diagrams. We haven't seen those diagrams yet, but what they show is similar to what is seen in other regions, namely that the uncertainties in the ground motion models dominate over the uncertainties in the seismic source characterization models. And that is true based upon the uncertainties, the known epistemic uncertainties, those that are accounted for by the model. However, there are undeclared epistemic uncertainties, things we don't know about, unknown unknowns, if you want to think of it that way, that we worry about. You know, that maybe some of our assumptions are wrong, maybe our error bars are too tight, and that the Earth behavior lies outside the behaviors that are consistent with the models that we have. We call that type of uncertainty ontological uncertainty, and we think the ontological uncertainty on the seismic source characterization models is probably greater than that on the ground motion models. So the ground motion models have probably captured more of the actual uncertainty than the seismic source characterization model. So that's a concern to keep in mind. We agree with the response plan that PG&E has put forward. There's a few areas where we would quibble, and of course recommendation two that Mike talked about is an example of that, because there is this hypothesis that the difference between the long-term rate and the current rate might be due to underestimation of the current rate because of the substance of the offshore platforms. The data that currently exists, as Chris pointed out, does not favor that hypothesis, but we think that hypothesis should be rigorously tested so that we could accept the alternative hypothesis that there's actually been a change of rate over the last 5 million years. And of course, as this project develops, there'll be more technical information that will be put forward by PG&E, and we look forward to that because in terms of being able to fully review their plan. So I'll end it with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And also, thank you to the consultants. We'll have discussion now that relate to the recommendations and the report. If I were to start, and then we'll also entertain public comment before taking any actions related to next steps here and such. One of the insights I think that I'm drawing is that the advances in the geodetic studies have been significant, and furthermore, it's my intuition that those types of studies have the potential to provide even greater insights in the longer term, to be able to improve faster, just because of the ability to collect data over large areas. Is that?
Yeah, well, as Scott has pointed out, the data has really improved significantly. However, geodetic data has the quality that it can't really pin down slip rates on individual faults. So what you really have to do is look at a fault system, look at the overall deformation associated with that fault system, and see if that's consistent with the geodetic data. So that's what we have proposed in those recommendations.
Yeah.
Scott, do you want to make any other comments on that?
Yeah, thank you. I would point out that the value of the geodetic data, beyond what's already been said, is that it's completely independent of all of these other types of data. Mm-hmm. It's a satellite looking at the ground, watching the ground move. And so you can do all of these dating of terraces and geologic work. The geodesy doesn't know about that work. It's a totally independent check on these other estimates for things. And yeah, like Tom said, it's gotten a lot better. So I think it's, as the USGS has done, they've integrated geodetic modeling into their National Seismic Hazard Model. And I think PG&E can do the same now, and it sounds like they agree.
Yeah, and
it also could provide some insights onto slip rates of other faults, like the Rinconada and Wassenaar faults, and potentially even maybe some information about the Hosbury fault.
Exactly. I think the ability to make these independent measurements allows one to test your other models in a very important way. So if I were to summarize, I think that there's alignment between the SRT's review and the PG&E recommendations, except on recommendation 2. But there, the alignment is more about what would be the scope and the idea that a very small amount of work or limited work could address the questions on recommendation 2. So
that's correct.
So the for us, and we'll have to have additional discussion, but for us to be able to accept the PG&E response, I think we have to address that recommendation 2, maybe some other things. But if PG&E is willing to sort of amend their response a little bit in that area, that might allow us to move forward on this.
Thank you. Please. Thank you very much, Professor Jordan, Professor Scott Marshall, and Mike Askin. Speaking on alignment, I asked this question from Dr. Chris Madugo yesterday after they presented their table, the summary table. I asked a question about how do they define impact and what is their criterion, or what are their criteria for impact? And you have, Professor Jordan, on the SRT also a table, summary table that you showed. You have a column, for potential hazard impact. What are your criteria, or is your criterion for impact? That's my first question.
Right, so I would say there's three aspects of that. One is the impact it might have on the estimate of hazard. So it could the hazard could go up or the hazard could go down if the potential for having large changes in hazard is high, then we would give it we would say it have a high impact. The second aspect has to do with the uncertainties. There are very large uncertainties associated with many of the model aspects of the model, and we want to reduce those uncertainties. So if we can reduce the uncertainty by doing the right kind of research, then we would say that also has a high impact. And then thirdly, we have these models. PG&E has done a very good job trying to develop the best possible model, but you want to be able to check the model. You want to be able to validate the model. And so if a program to validate the model can be put into place, we would also say that has a high impact. So those are the three criteria that we have used.
Okay, thank you very much. My follow-up question is, under the impact, they have rated your 9 recommendations either low or unknown. Whereas you, in your summary, you have rated your recommendations between medium and maybe one low or something. And basically, this disparity between PG&E's perception, understanding, and implication of your recommendations versus your scientific, technical analysis of implications and importance and impact of your recommendation. I think this gap, it's not a chasm, it's a gap. That needs to be reconciled.
Well, I think, you know, PG&E is being perhaps a little more conservative than we are in terms of trying to assess potential hazard impact. And so, for example, as they point out, we won't be able to assess how the value of hazard might change based on some of these recommendations until after the sensitivity analyses are done. And that's correct. So what we've done is we've tried to assess that based upon the types of hypotheses that could be tested with these recommendations. So for example, if you take recommendation number 2, the reason why we think that's important is because if there were a significant subsidence offshore, that would increase the estimated fault slip rate of the thrust faults beneath the plant. And so that could have a potentially high impact on the hazard. Now, there is data, and Chris talked about this last night, that suggests that these platforms aren't subsiding. For example, there's no sedimentary basin associated with that subsidence. So you could say, well, okay, that's probably not an important point. But we would like to see a thorough and well-documented test of that hypothesis relative to the alternative hypothesis that the rates have actually changed over the last 5 billion years. So that's the kind. So our assessment is that that has potential impact on the hazard. And again, it might not be so much the fact that it's going to change the hazard, but that you can say that this hypothesis can be rejected.
Tom, could I? I think there's another key thing, which is the SRT's focus was on bird critique and thrust faulting. And there's a position that the hazard is actually dominated by Hosgree. And so if you're interested in the thrust faulting, you'd have higher impact than if you're interested in the overall hazard, which is dominated by the Hosgree. So could you discuss whether that might also
be involved
in the differences?
The reason why a lot of these things are said to be of medium importance is because we have other issues that are of higher importance. And so the Hosgree rate, I think we would all admit, is one of those. As I pointed out, we did not prioritize our recommendations because we recognize that prioritization has to be put into the framework of a larger program, and we had not done the analysis of a larger program to be able to do that. But it will be interesting as this project goes forward to see how those impact statements might change.
What is, Professor Jordan, what is your interpretation of PG&E usage of the word unknown for impact? Because this is, to me, is a very non-committmental response.
Well, I think they're again, just being conservative. I think they're focusing primarily on the issue of the hazard value. So I think from their point of view, for an issue to have a high potential impact, it would have to change that hazard value significantly. Our use of that term, potential impact, encompasses more than just the value of the hazard, but also the question of uncertainty, reduction, and validation of models.
And my last question, so thanks for indulgence. What does it take to reconcile your impact rating with PG&E impact rating? Do you need to talk with them? You need to have a conference with Dr. Chris Madugo and his team? Because for me sitting here, I see your recommendation number 9 is, as you said, overarching recommendation, and it's a very important one. You consider that as its research priority being high, its impact being important, and then PG&E says it's unknown.
Right. Well, I think we assign that a medium importance, number 9, because what it's doing is it's evaluating issues that probably would have a could potentially have a medium impact on the hazard, probably not the highest impact, because, again, there are other issues that would have a higher impact. So these scales are typically relative, and so that has to be taken into account. In terms of reconciling the two, I suspect you could push PG&E to fill out those unknowns. They would come up with statements about what they know now in terms of those impacts, and I don't think those would be terribly different from the ones we've listed.
I look at my colleagues on the committee, Dr. Scullett and Dr. Peterson. I think this is an important gap that stays in my mind, maybe not. This thing needs to be reconciled, because if PG&E, for many of these recommendations, says it's unknown, meaning that they are not sure what's the impact, and they are doing that just to accepting the SRT recommendation out of goodness of their heart or politeness or something. But this needs to be somehow resolved or reconciled, this unknown versus low, medium, and that. And maybe if we can elaborate on why the rationale for they call that unknown, while it's an important
issue. Well, the SRT can't do that. PG&E could do that for you.
That's right.
We can ask. We'll ask for PG&E's input here in a second.
Yes, so on the sensitivity analysis, a follow-up comment to Dr. Mashkati. Once the initial results of the sensitivity analysis are generated, would that enable PG&E to update this priority list?
I think so, yes. So, you know, the sensitivity studies, as they point out, are complex and involve a number of model elements. So it's hard to kind of guess ahead of time what the sensitivity analysis is going to show. So I think that's part of the reason they say the impact is unknown. And what they're doing is waiting until they have that sensitivity analysis and they'll be able to do a better job of assessing the impact.
So it would seem timely to me that the committee follows up on this alignment after the sensitivity mm-hmm. analysis is done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that this overall program that's being outlined, the sensitivity analysis have a very high priority by PG&E. Mm-hmm. They're working hard to get this SSM approved so they can use that. And if I understand it, they're expecting at least some preliminary results during the next calendar year. Perhaps applying that to the fault geometry models that the SRT has discussed. To apply it to all of the areas of concern in the recommendation set is probably going to take them longer than that, but probably that will go faster than some of the research that's being discussed.
And you talked about ontological uncertainty. Will this sensitivity analysis tool allow them to evaluate the impact of this ontological uncertainty?
Well, the problem with ontological uncertainty is that it's based upon things you do not know. If you knew them, you would put it into your uncertainty budget, right? And so everybody tries to put as much information into the uncertainty budget as they can, but on things you don't know about, it's hard to, you can't do that, right? So it's a very subjective problem as to trying to assess the potential for ontological uncertainty. So this is basically, what's the potential for a surprise, for something that just is outside the realm at which the model would forecast? And of course, we see that happen a lot, where you know an earthquake will occur in a place we didn't expect, or with an intensity we didn't expect, and that's type of ontological uncertainty is difficult to deal with.
But sometimes bounding events can be defined, even though we can't imagine how we could possibly get to that bounding scenario, and then that could be fed into an sensitivity analysis. Is this the kind of model that they're developing?
No, I think I don't. This issue of ontological uncertainty, we have just raised that. In fact, just raised it in this presentation. It's not something that has been widely discussed within the hazard community.
Very good. I note that we have Scott Marshall has his hand up and I think has some comments. I think this is also an appropriate time for us to get feedback from PG&E. And then maybe a little bit of additional discussion, but also feedback from members of the public. So Scott, could you go ahead and give us any additional thoughts and comments?
Yeah, in regards to the anticipated impacts being unknown, I note that several of those unknowns were under the geodetic work. And I think the idea is that if you do all of this geodetic modeling and you use the model parameters from the current SSC and you fit the geodetic data very well, then that is an excellent independent test of the model. And that's why they're saying the impact is unknown, because if you don't find that there's any significant mismatches between the satellite data and an input based on the SSC, then it's a validation and nothing needs to be changed. But if you do find significant mismatch and other types of this data, then the impact could be larger. Like maybe some of the parameters need to be rethought. So when I read unknown for the geodetic, I didn't read that as PG&E saying it's not important. It was them saying we can't say what the impact's going to be until we do the work.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
It does. Very
but
good.
But of course, that's probably a question best addressed by Chris Madugo, but that's when the SRT read it, I believe that was our opinion.
Excellent. At this point, I invite PG&E to give us feedback on discussion related to the recommendations and also in particular if we can clarify what the path forward will be on recommendation 2.
All right. I'm Jeff Bockheber, Director of Geosciences for PG&E, standing in for Chris as well as I can. But first off, per your question and Dr. Mershkadi, about the unknowns, how we put down the impact. This is something we need to collect the data, perform the sensitivity analysis, then we'll have an understanding of what that impact will be. So it's part of that process. We'll collect the data, perform specific sensitivity evaluations, and then we'll have a better picture of what the impacts will be.
Meaning that this is still in work in progress. You haven't decided it's going to be low, high, or medium.
That's correct.
Undecided, basically. I can write under unknown, undecided.
I think an unknown is an appropriate term to use at this point. And as we collect the data, perform the sensitivity, we'll be reporting out periodically because the process of the investigations that we'll be doing 2 to 3 year time period. Once we collect enough data, we could perform the sensitivity studies. So these will be progressive over time. Mm-hmm. But as we complete sensitivity studies, we can have periodic update reports on that. So you can see the process and understand how this picture is developing.
Question on that, just from the one who keeps track of follow-up items and when and such, what time frame do you think would be appropriate for a future update to the Committee on Progress?
We're targeting the June public meeting to present what we have collected and processed to that time. So a couple things that we'll have prepared. One is updated tornado plots. And so I know you're dying to see those, the SRT team. And so we'll present those in June. We also will be evaluating a comment made by Phil Johnson last night about the 100% weight. So he's recommending mm-hmm. that we assign that for the Cross-Hoskery slope slip. We have performed that evaluation and reported last year on it that using the hazard model that we had at that time, that it was an insignificant amount. It had a slight increase, but insignificant to hazard. Now that we have our hazard model updated, we'll rerun that evaluation, present that in June. So we have some good stuff we'll be reporting out in June.
Great, thank you.
Excellent. And then on recommendation two, that is one where there's not alignment between SRT and PG&E in terms of the path forward. But SRT's position is that I think it's some relatively simple and not expensive effort could reduce that uncertainty there. And therefore, I think they continue to want something to be done with recommendation two.
It sounds like you are agreeing to the alternate approach that we have, where we can collect data instead of direct dating of the shelf. We will be performing that work. Chris mentioned last night that one of the first sensitivity tests we can do is to evaluate the potential impact of that, of having the subsidence, you know, to different levels. And so that will help us understand that.
Okay, that's good, because then I think that means that there's alignment between SRT and PG&E on recommendations and path forward, and moreover, that the potential for us to have a presentation in June on this topic is I think a good idea as well. So additional thoughts or comments from PG&E on this, and then we'll move to public comment.
Yeah, we've appreciated the process. So really good ideas, the recommendations. We evaluated each one specifically, and I think this is a well-functioning process for the recommendations and our response. So we appreciate the input that we've received. It will help us definitely build out our models. I think a lot of the work will confirm already what we've been developing in our past studies. So that's our anticipation in some cases.
Very good. In that case, then, I think we've had enough discussion. We're running a little bit over the time that we had allotted. So I'd like to open the floor now for public comment from members of the public. And Supervisor Gibson, it would be wonderful to have your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Bruce Gibson, 2nd District Supervisor for the County of San Luis Obispo and a member of the IPRP. And in that role, I want to speak to the issues that Dr. Scarlett raised, which are the essential ones. I find it interesting, as a technical member of the IPRP and a local elected official, a lot of my role is making that translation to the lay public as to what the consequences of this technical work is. And I should emphasize that I am not an expert in seismic hazard, that my work in seismology was different. The way I characterize it is I speak their language, but I can't write poetry in it. So Dr. Jordan raised an important point about the probabilistic nature of this, is probabilistic seismic hazard. And so I'm thinking in terms of probable cause. My own understanding of the situation as regards the bird contentions, and Dr. Jordan, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the kinematics of the tectonics there, the mm-hmm. amount of slip that might be seen accommodated in the Irish Hills is relatively low, much lower than the slip that we see on the Hawsgree Fault itself. And as such, the likely contribution to the seismic hazard is relatively low. Now, I go back to the sense that this is a probabilistic seismic hazard analysis. So while the potential for a probability of a significant event, a threatening event, is low, it's not zero. And it raises the whole question, which is a discussion for another day, about whether probabilistic seismic hazard analysis is the right foundation for public policy. We have here events that are extremely low probability of occurring, but if they occur, they could have exceedingly huge impacts. And so as my, as I look at representing the physical place where any, God forbid, such impacts would be visited, It's my deep concern that the ontological uncertainty be resolved as soon as possible. I would note the tornado diagram, to my view, is epistemic uncertainty. And indeed, ground motions and Hasgri slip rate are the things we need to nail down. But the potential contribution to hazard from the Irish Hills is not on the tornado diagram because of the ontological uncertainty. And so my comment would be, as I look at PG&E's response and the SRT's continued discussion with them, the three-year timeline would be something I would like to see accelerated. Reducing uncertainty, coming to a better understanding for my constituents, for my fellow residents of this county, is huge. And so anything that the DCISC could do to push this timeline forward to alleviate the ontological uncertainty and to put it into perspective with the epistemic uncertainties that we deal with would be greatly appreciated.
Can you clarify the three-year timeline for...
For understanding these, so...
For the sensitivity analysis?
Well, we're looking into the geologic structure of the Irish Hills. You know, let me give you the example. As Dr. Jordan indicated, especially as regards blind thrust faults, the most significant impacts of earthquakes in my lifetime came from such earthquakes. The Sylmar earthquake, 71, Northridge, 94, and Coalinga, 87, or something like that. We didn't know that the transpression was great enough to actually trigger a very significant earthquake. I would submit that we still don't know the geologic structure of the Irish Hills completely well enough to rule that out at a particular level of certainty. Again, the kinematics suggest maybe there's not enough energy, if you will, to be put into that system to cause a problem. But again, from where I sit, not far from this plant, I would like to have that resolved quickly.
Thank you. Importantly also, of course, is the response of the plant.
Correct.
To earthquakes.
Correct.
And, of course, we've studied that a lot. In fact, coming from mechanical engineering and having some understanding of structural engineering and seismic response of structures, I probably have a better understanding of that area. And the plant is engineered extraordinarily robustly from that perspective. So you ask the people that are familiar with the structural response and are responsible for understanding that, and what they'll tell you is they really don't think there's any way that the plant could fail. So then you push on that. You ask, well, if it did fail, what would that look like? And generally it comes to the turbine building and safety-related electrical equipment. That's probably what would fail. This is where we get into the strategies around managing these ontological risks, because when you think about beyond design basis accidents, they're much more frequently things that were missed by the engineers, not things that exceeded some low probability that they have. And that's the reason that we've also pushed a lot on the question of flex response, sure, having the equipment, and then you immediately realize, well, you need the people too, which is also why the committee has had a strong focus on workplace seismic safety at the plant and making sure that you're translating those things back to your home as well. Because another thing that you know in these events could be the case is that the workforce at the plant could be distracted because they're deeply concerned about what's happened to their families.
And understood. Also, well, understood. And as a pilot, I understand pilot error. So, Dr. Scarlett?
Dr. Marshall, with state-of-the-art techniques, is it feasible to accelerate the timeline of what was proposed to less than 3 years? Is that even possible?
Are you asking me, Dr. Marshall?
Yes.
I think do you mean to all of the recommendations or specific ones?
Well, I of course, am here advocating everything should happen next week, but that's...
So the timelines we saw for improved model development were 3 years. Is that because it's a resource allocation priority question, or is it because that's just how long it takes for state-of-the-art technology to be used that way?
I think mostly it's just that's how long it takes, because, you know, people have to do the work, and you have to get their time, and people aren't available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and so these things end up taking time, and especially the geodetic work will need multiple people involved. But that doesn't mean that there won't be any results for 3 years. I think there are there's some low-hanging fruit in all of these recommendations that can be done in the next year. Like PG&E already reported that they've created this SSM model and are reporting on results by June, which is we're very interested to see those results. But don't think that we're saying nothing will be done until 3 years. It's just a matter of to complete the studies is probably going to take several years, yes.
Excellent. Okay, let's get a comment from PG&E, and then I do want to continue for the public comment period. We do need to move forward, and then I think I'm seeing the path forward emerging in terms of the committee's actions, but we need to get the feedback from PG&E and from the public.
All right, so I'll address a question about the time frame. This is Jeff Bockeberg, yeah. PG&E. And we need to do proper work. And so what we have built out already is a pretty aggressive program. We have multiple studies occurring at the same time, and we involve significant review processes, third-party review, so we can count on the data that we develop. If you try to rush it, you will not have that degree of confidence in the data mm-hmm. and the review process. So it's what it takes.
And for the sensitivity analysis?
Yeah, and those will be reporting out as we collect the data to a level where we could perform the sensitivity analysis on specific items. So like what Scott said, we will be periodically providing updates, and that will include the sensitivity studies that we can do once we have the data collected.
And we'll have an update at the June meeting.
Yes.
I think the point you made about third-party review and proper work and the impact that accelerating would have on the quality of the work is really important.
It is. And we've found in the past studies, they really benefit when they have been put through professional publications because then they're referenceable and it brings them to a higher level. And so we have planned that these studies will result in peer-reviewed journal papers and such. And so that gives it that credibility.
Thank you. Excellent. I'd like to entertain additional public comment.
Gene Nelson, Californians for Green Nuclear Power. First of all, as somebody that's been watching this process, starting from the initial Byrd contentions to where we are today, I'm very impressed with the evolution and the fact that PG&E has been quite responsive and the fact that the committee has also been responsive by developing the SRT. So that's, I think, a really good thing. Relating to what Dr. Gibson said, CGNP also interacts with the public. We have a booth at the Slow Downtown Farmers Market. We've had that since 2017. And we get a lot of questions. And my summary, as I digest this material, is that if the big one hits, or when the big one hits, because it's not an if, it's a when the big one hits, I would much rather be at Diablo Canyon than any place else in San Luis Obispo County, because it is so well engineered for likely, plausible, defensible earthquakes. Another thing that I do, though, to kind of refresh my memory, is every time I travel to Sacramento, which I do a lot, I make a point of stopping off at a place called Colleen. Now, Colleen is where the San Andreas Fault intersects Highway 4146. And I go look at a piece of gas transmission pipeline that I believe the PUC ordered be taken above the ground to facilitate repairs after the next earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. And I continue to look at how that just has been gradually bending more and more through a process called a seismic creep. And it just really grounds me to see this, the fact that we do have a living laboratory here in San Luis Obispo County. There's really cool things going on. And of course, I also take the time to go to Wallace Creek periodically. And that really helps me to get perspective over the last 3,800 years. So, again, I'm very impressed with what's going on. Thank you.
Thank you. Additional public comment? Thank you. And as always, please introduce yourself.
Good morning. I'm Linda Seeley from Mothers for Peace. I have a few questions for you. First, I'd like to comment that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I think that the SRT was brought together because of Dr. Bird's report that was subsidized, I guess is the right word, by San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. We were concerned about the conditions of how much we knew about the seismic risk at Diablo. And so we, an all-volunteer nonprofit organization, had to raise the funds to pay a renowned expert to look at the data. And now we have this whole blooming set of data about the the seismic conditions at Diablo Canyon. It's ironic to me that it would take a nonprofit group of all volunteers to have this happen. It also concerns me because PG&E was willing to go ahead and say everything is hunky-dory at Diablo Canyon seismically. And then you hired the IRP. SRT.
SRT.
Now, PG&E is going, as I commented last night, PG&E is planning on hiring, I think, one or two members of the SRT to work with them. I think that is a very bad idea. I think you need to keep an independent panel of experts so that you, again, if you need to challenge PG&E's assumptions, that you have the ability to do that. When they are hired by PG&E, then they are with PG&E. And there's already a little, I detect, kind of a cozy relationship anyway, which I think happens when you work with somebody, even if you're on opposing sides of the issue, such as Mothers for Peace and PG&E. You know, over the years, I've gotten to be very familiar with people at PG&E and like them tremendously and feel very comfortable with them. But if you're doing something that's supposed to be really independent, you have to keep it that way. And back to the ontological uncertainty, I remind you that that was Donald Rumsfeld, our Secretary of Defense, who said that initially, right? And what he was talking about was the relationship of the Iraqi government to terrorist groups, specifically ISIS, I believe, promoting the fact that there was this deep relationship between those two. It cost over 1 million Iraqi lives. And I can't remember how many allied lives were lost in that horrible war that we caused. We have to know, there should not be unknown unknowns when you're looking, and there should not be a nuclear power plant running on faults that are unknown. It's, if you were real, I know my time is up. I implore you to remember your own independence and your own remit to be a defender of the public, to not be a defender of PG&E and not endorse their safety message. Be skeptical. You have the power. We don't. Thank you.
Thank you. Checking to see, do we have additional public comment potentially online?
Yes, we have two speakers on Zoom. If any other member of the public would like to speak, please raise your hand now. First speaker will be James Swanson, followed by Ace Huffman.
Thank you.
Jane Swanson, go
yes.
ahead.
Yes. Jane Swanson here. My comment is on matters not on today's agenda, so maybe I should let Ace Hoffman go first.
We will be covering matters not on the agenda at the end of the morning session. However, I'd be willing to entertain doing it now since everybody's queued up to do so. Is that okay?
I would appreciate doing it now because I will have a medical appointment in about half an hour.
In that case,
so
then yes,
come back later.
For sure.
Okay. All right. Thank you for accommodating me. I appreciate that. And I'll be brief. I have questions regarding the testing of capsule B for the redolent of Unit 1. On Wednesday, PG&E stated that the results of this test will be reported to the Independent Safety Committee in May, but not to the NRC until sometime in the fall. So my question is, why the delay? How does PG&E justify withholding the test results from the federal regulator for several months? And when will the results be available to the public, which has been awaiting this information for over two decades? We also heard that the test results will be submitted confidentially to the Independent Safety Committee, but publicly available when submitted to the NRC. That's pretty much a quote of what PG&E said yesterday. And my question is, why cannot these results be public from the very beginning? What's the reason for withholding from the public?
I can comment. I think the independent review and the layers of review that happen with every document are very important. And we heard about, you know, how is it that we use these engineering tools in policy making? It's unwise, I think, to issue an unfinal report that then may influence public policy. So I think it's the right thing to do to make sure that the document that is issued to the public is indeed ready for public comment. Now, does this timeline impact timely decision-making? My understanding is that it does not. The NRC would have indicated if that was the case, so the timeline is following the NRC expectations. So I would look to that to see if we're meeting the correct timelines.
Thank you. Okay, moving on, additional public comments?
Ace Hoffman, go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. I was listening all day yesterday, and I'm going to have to leave at 10:30 today or 10 o'clock. So I just want to make a couple of comments about yesterday. One of the things was that you specifically said that your mandate is to make sure that the plant runs safely. And I think that's a mistaken way of putting it. Your mandate is to make sure that the public is protected from the plant. and that the public is safe. And so you need to take into account everything that is related to what the plant does. And related specifically to the spent fuel, 10 years ago, I was talking to Gene, and he said he would be happy to take the waste from San Onofre and bring it up to Diablo Canyon where it could be safely protected. It's not safe down to San Onofre where I am. And we've been trying for 12 years to get rid of the waste. And we've got, you know, a congressman involved and everything. We can't get rid of it. There's mayors and so forth. So if the waste is really safe, how about taking ours? And I also heard yesterday talk about running the plant for 107 years, I think it was. You're going to have an awful lot of dry casks. You're going to have, at ours, you're going to have maybe 300 or 400 dry casks. So when you do this earthquake analysis, you have to do it for 400 different dry casks. And are they going to crash into each other? Is there going to be an impact between them? And also, in terms of the drones that were mentioned yesterday, your worry is not whether a single drone is going to come in. Your worry is a drone swarm. And this is something that I've been a computer programmer for about 40 years, and I'm pretty sure my software is used in similar types of machines for the U.S. And your worry is a drone swarm with highly sophisticated equipment. And I don't have any idea how you plan to protect against that, and I haven't heard anything. Lastly, since I know I'm running out of time, I do want to say that the spokespeople from Diablo Canyon, it used to be called DCNPP, it's now called DCPP, I don't know how the name changed, but I was very impressed yesterday with all of them, and I didn't expect that, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate what seemed like very honest opinions, openness, and so forth. It was truly a pleasure to hear people that I couldn't expect that I don't agree with in the final analysis. And I wish I could say the same about the board members of the DCIC ISC. I wasn't so impressed with them. Hopefully in the last part that I get close and pull out of the change. Thank you very much. That's all.
Thank you.
That was the last speaker on Zoom.
Do we have additional speakers?
If I could comment. Please. Thank you very much for that point. I just wanted to read from the charter of what our scope is for this committee. We are to review the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant operations for the purpose of assessing the safety of operations, which includes, of course, the plant and its spent fuel, and making recommendations appropriate to enhance safety of operations. That's the language. So I was following that language. Now, should that language need to change, of course, that can be a discussion. And then there's a outreach scope for the committee, which is the committee should undertake public outreach in the affected community. That's our two scopes. So is our scope to ensure that the public is protected? I think that's yes, but no. It's PG&E's responsibility to ensure that the public is protected. Our scope is to review the operations of the plant and make recommendations with regards to safety. So I just wanted to sort of make that clarification. But yes, spent fuel is certainly included in as part of our scope. Thank you for that comment.
Very good. Okay, I think that we've concluded the public comment period. We can now move into regulatory and administrative matters, which will include, making a decision about recommendations. But at this point, I'd like to turn things over to our counsel, Bob Rathy, to lead us through this whole set of topics that we have next on our agenda.
And I can do that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And this will be the report under item 22G. The first thing I would start out with is we might want to consider our actions regarding our 35th annual report, which today was, we've received now PG&E's response. And there were more recommendations, by the way, in the annual report than the 9 seismic recommendations. PG&E also responded. There were a total of 15 recommendations in that report. So the committee may want to consider accepting those responses, 50 responses. If you have, and we've discussed, subject to our discussion this morning on certain matters that we'll follow up, but it would probably be good to put a period to accepting those responses. And when I say accepting the responses, it's different than approving the responses. We are just accepting them. We're putting a period to our 35th annual report and moving on to our 36th annual report. So we could simply do that by motion to accept the responses.
Prior to doing that, though, I think that we may want to discuss what specific actions the committee is going to take, which provide the context then for accepting the recommendations.
That would be appropriate.
And clearly, we will have the seismic response and presentations as something we'll cover in the June public meeting. And we expect to have at that point an update from PG&E, which they committed to during this meeting. I think we also need to discuss our plans for continuing review on our side, and in particular the consulting support for that. We don't have direct subject matter expertise on the committee in the area of seismic risk and hazard, which is the reason why Dr. Meshkadi originally helped us to convene, interview consultants, and ultimately to form the SRT.
And I could speak to that a little bit.
Let's do that, because okay. I think let's do that first before we do.
Right, because it is certainly germane to the 35th annual report. I have prepared a resolution, essentially, as we did for our October meeting, essentially addressing the presentation that was made today by Dr. Jordan and his colleagues, Dr. Oskin and Dr. Marshall, and also what we've heard last night from PG&E. And the next steps that I would submit for your consideration would be to ask the SRT to prepare a preliminary evaluation in the form of a letter-type submission to the committee that would be based upon the comments and information and the data received during the SRT's review of the PG&E response. And by the way, this is based upon Dr. Jordan's suggestion to me as we were getting ready to consider this this matter. And so then that report would come to us as a placeholder at this point in time. I understand we're going to be doing more things in the future. But then at this point, we would then, as we said in our October meeting, we adopted a resolution at that time, that we would then sever our contractual relationship with Dr. Marshall and Dr. Oskin and allow them to pursue other opportunities. Well, all the work that we've discussed today through 2026 and 2027 would be occurring, and this would allow them to pursue other research opportunities, possibly with PG&E or others. So that would be the intent of the resolution this morning, considering the next steps for the SRT. They would prepare us an evaluation letter at this point in time, and we would take that under submission and go forward.
Can I propose that the evaluation letter responds to the public comment we received today with regards to how we ensure the possibility for independent review in the future? And I think that the members of the SRT would have the right expertise to address that. So in being released to from the SRT, if they could also comment on how we can achieve that as a committee.
And I do think our intention is, and I believe that Dr. Jordan is willing to do that, is to retain Dr. Jordan as
Correct.
A consultant for the committee for the foreseeable future.
And Dr. Jordan, I believe, has agreed to work with us on that. And that was part of our October resolution, the intent of the committee in October.
Yeah.
That would continue.
And I, we did a pretty comprehensive study to review the bird critique with the three members of the SRT. However, it's not really the committee's function to perform seismic hazard research and studies. It's better our function is to review those activities, which will include both PG&E's work, but also important to note, we have an independent peer review panel, which is charged with really the most important scope of reviewing the seismic hazard.
we specifically addressed the bird critique because it was not otherwise going to be done in the level of detail that we thought would be needed, in part because the consensus of the majority of people who work in this field who have expertise is that the hazard is dominated by the hosgreen, and that it's a misallocation to but that's we wanted to confirm that. So that means that we will have presuming, and I think we have confirmation that Dr. Jordan is willing to continue to serve as a consultant to the committee, we'll be able to get expert review. And of course, it's a complex field with multiple different domains, some of which nobody can be expert across all of them, but a good subject matter expert knows where to go get additional information if it's needed. And so I think that this would work. Also, it would not be fair of us to constrain the additional members of the SRT, given that we don't anticipate doing a large amount of work going forward. And therefore, I think releasing the other members at this point is an appropriate thing to do.
I just want to support your suggestion, Maserati, and that's an also very good suggestion, Dr. Scarlett, about asking SRT to address public concerns and public comment in this report that they say. And also add to what you said, I think I consider that as a good sign that PG&E has decided to ask Dr. Marshall and Dr. Oskin to help them with better understanding. I consider that really a great thing, and I salute PG&E, and I admire the scientific expertise of these two great scholars. I think this is a great moment for me and for us that something that we brought to the attention of the public, and PG&E has been picked up by PG&E, and they want to continue this suggestion. I think this is great. I commend everybody. And then back to your concern, ma'am, I think we have the chairman of SRT, Professor Thomas Jordan, still with us. He is an honorable scholar, and he will help us to monitor the next steps by PG&E. And also, we heard that from Dr. Gibson yesterday that IPRP new report 16A was just released. I think in the charter that Dr. Scala just read, there is one line about our relationship with IPRP. It says that IPRP is created by CPUC after the Senate Bill 846, and we need to consult and communicate with them and coordinate some of our activities. And I think that for that one, in light of this new IPRP report that Dr. Gibson sent some comments about that to Mr. Ratti, and it was shared with us, I think we still need expertise of Dr. Jordan to help us to decipher IPRP, to reconcile SRT report with PG&E response, and to understand IPRP's suggestion to PG&E based on this report 16A. That's why I think at the end, I think it's great that PG&E wants Dr. Oskin and Dr. Marshall to work with them, and we are privileged that Dr. Jordan has agreed to stay with us as an independent consultant on this monitoring task. Thank you.
Excellent. I think that we have a consensus on the committee, and I'll ask in a moment Bob Rathy to explain how it is we can formally move forward. However, this is a substantive issue that we've discussed, and so I think it's important to entertain public comment as well on this plan to move forward with respect to consulting support and additional actions for the SRT. Do we have any public comment?
If I could make a comment before we go into the next public comment, just to respond to the intervener expenses that we heard about earlier. Can we provide some information on intervener compensation options for groups that would like to do the type of work that we've seen here lead to good outcomes?
In my opinion, we should not do that.
We cannot do that.
Okay.
Yeah,
that is a separate matter. That's a Public Utilities Commission matter, completely separate from our role.
Okay.
I don't think we should get involved.
Okay.
In the intervener compensation.
Thank you for clarifying. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay.
Dr. Gene Nelson, Californians for Green Nuclear Power. CGNP serves as an intervener before the Public Utilities Commission, and I can guarantee you it is a very arcane and challenging process. There seems to be also some politics involved, CGNP, despite having put in thousands of hours, hasn't received a penny from the PUC since late 2018, while the opponents of Diablo Canyon Power Plant have collectively received multiple millions of dollars. So that's just a little thorn in our side, which I wanted to raise. But I wanted to comment that I strongly support the committee's decision to sever the relationship with Dr. Oskin and Dr. Marshall and continue to work with Dr. Jordan. Thank you.
Linda Seeley, Mothers for Peace. I very much appreciate your explanation of why you are approving why you're retaining Dr. Jordan and also allowing your other two seismologists to join with PG&E. It makes sense to me, and I appreciate your diligence.
Thank you. And any additional public comment online?
If any member of the public would like to speak, please raise your hand. If you're calling in by phone, you can dial *9 to raise your hand. All right. We have Kyle Berlin.
Yes?
Kyle Berlin, if you'd like to comment, please unmute your microphone.
My apologies. I didn't mean to raise my hand. I was just listening, but thank you.
Right. Thank you very much.
We have no speakers on Zoom.
In that case, then, I think we can move forward to take action. Bob, right. could you state what it is we're going to do?
Yeah, and then I think it would be appropriate to introduce a motion with a second to a motion to accept PG&E's response as supplemented to the 35th annual report of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee and to adopt Resolution 2026-04 regarding the next steps in the process of reviewing the next steps by the SRT. The operative section of that resolution, I won't read the whole thing, is that the DCISC hereby directs that the SRT to submit a preliminary evaluation report in letter form based upon the comments received, which would include the public comments, and the view graphs, which would be attached, used during the SRT's presentation on February 19th at the DCISC public meeting. So we would be receiving that report subsequent, probably, at the June meeting. So a motion to accept the PG&E response as supplemented to the 35th annual report and to adopt Resolution 26.
That sounds good. And then we'll follow with the actions related to consultants.
Those would be contractual, yes.
Perfect, okay.
And we adopted a resolution in October setting forth our intent to do that.
Okay. Yeah. Also moved.
Second.
All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Perfect.
Okay. So we'll move on from that administrative matter. And the next thing I'll speak to is another resolution, and this has to do with an action that we took yesterday approving the January 2021 fact-finding report. And as during the discussion, as Consultant McWhorter could speak to, there were a couple of amendments to that report. So that report will be adopted. If this resolution is adopted, it would be adopted with those amendments. In that fact-finding report, there is a recommendation or a suggestion that a recommendation be made to the Public Utilities Commission. And this has to do with the funding, the support for the funding for the feedwater heater replacement project. Now, I've been advised by the Public Utilities Commission Energy Division, Mr. Zismore, that this matter is coming up before, I don't know that it'll necessarily go, it's coming up in a proceeding in the Public Utilities Commission that has to do with allocations of the volumetric performance fees, which are an element of phase two of the rulemaking proceeding that came out of SB 846. And there is a new funding tranche for that proceeding that will be open through the end of March 31st that may have a component regarding funding for the future of the feedwater heater project. And we've taken the position in that fact-finding report that we think that should be supported, that that project should be supported. So rather than waiting until our annual report, which is, runs through June, and we actually don't have the report before us in October, it doesn't seem the right course of action for us not to transmit that recommendation to the CPUC. So this the resolution that I prepared includes that recommendation in verbatim in full and would be accompanied also by a copy of the final fact-finding report. Mm-hmm. So a motion to adopt that resolution would be appropriate way to do that, and that would be resolution 2026-03, and that includes the recommendation in full regarding the feedback.
Thank you, Ms. Serrati. I don't see any problem in that. It basically piggybacks on our recommendation, which was approved yesterday.
It's essentially a way to convey our recommendation in a more timely way.
If my colleagues here agree, I'm in agreement on that. Thank you.
I second.
Should we?
We could entertain public comment.
We should entertain any public comment on this. Decision to essentially forward the fact-finding report and recommendations to CPUC.
Dr. Gene Nelson, Californians for Green Nuclear Power. I just restate CGNP's approval and endorsement of that plan of action. Thank you.
Thank you. Additional public comment.
Linda Seeley, Mothers for Peace, sorry to take your time, but question, does this mean that there's going to be an addition to the volumetric performance fee monetarily for customers of PG&E?
No, my understanding is no. This is an allocation of the fees that have already been before the Public Utilities Commission.
Okay, so they'll spread it out.
Right. In other words, what are those fees going to be used for? In this case, I think what the committee would be saying is we think that some of those fees should be used for the feedwater heater replacement program.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Okay, any additional public comment online?
Yes, we have one speaker online. If anyone else would like to speak, please raise your hand. We have a number starting with 823. Go ahead.
And please introduce yourself.
Go ahead. I can see your microphone is unmuted, but we do not hear you.
Hello?
Yes, now we hear you now.
Can you hear me? This is Robert Sarvey. I didn't hear you announce my name. I support you making individual recommendations on issues that the DCIS believes need to be covered. I don't see anything. I'm involved in the current proceeding. I haven't seen anything about VPF funding used for feedwater heaters. So that's news to me. I'm more concerned about your 34th annual report and the fact that PG&E has convinced the Public Utilities Commission that you've made no recommendations. And those recommendations are important because if the DCIC recommends an upgrade, that needs to go into the collective costs of the project, and at that point, the CPUC needs to determine whether it's cost-effective or not anymore. So it's very important that they get that information that you provided them in the 34th annual report and make sure they understand that was your recommendations, because they clearly do not understand that. They've taken PG&E's position that you've made no recommendations. So that's all I had to say, but thank you for the opportunity.
That was the only speaker on Zoom.
Excellent. Any additional public comment? All right, so we have a motion and a second. So at this point, it's up to us to vote. I'm going to vote for aye.
Aye.
Okay, it's approved.
Okay, next. Moving on to some more mundane matters. Well, they're exciting to me. I'll speak a little bit to our funding. We are now moving forward in this year, 2026, with a new baseline funding methodology, I'll call it, a calculation, which was approved in phase two of the rulemaking proceeding that concluded late in 2025. And so now we have a method of establishing our baseline funding, starting going forward in 2026, and that methodology will continue for future funding. And it's based upon the funding, the expenses of the committee, the expenditures by the committee in the years 2023, 2024, and 2025. The new funding mechanism will provide us with a significant increase from the funding that would have been available under the former method of funding the committee. So that's a very good thing. But I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, as I'm constantly saying, I think you're probably all tired of hearing me, but we need to live within our means, and we are living in a time of increasing costs. So as we move forward, I want to be recommend that we be prudent in our expenditures. But we do have a new funding methodology that will be in place for this year and in succeeding years. And I can answer any questions on that if we need to. But and I have to say, PG&E, I want to express my appreciation to PG&E, because during this time since the adoption of SB 846 in September of 2022, the DCISC funding has been a challenging experience to determine how much funding we're going to need, where that funding is going to come from. The Public Utilities Commission did establish what they call the Diablo Canyon Transition and Relicensing Memorandum Account, which provided a stream of funding to us separate from our baseline funding that allowed us to review, do additional work regarding relicensing and transition activities. That funding terminated as of August 26th, and there was a resolution of all that. So moving forward, our funding situation should be much simpler in the future, and I appreciate PG&E working with us and providing the funding that we needed in a very timely way. So we have remained solvent during this entire period. So that takes care of my discussion. If there's any questions on funding, I'll be glad to try to answer those.
Thank you. It's an important, of course. We have done substantial additional work over the last several years because of the plant life extension, and we're still learning what additional things we need to do. So I think this coming quarter will be important for
us
to track expenses closely, and as we bring in additional activities and consultants to be cautious about that.
And that's going to be coming up right now. And I would say I think it's important for the public to know that we have not had to curtail or postpone or in any way defer any of our review activities during this period. We've continued to do everything that we thought we needed to do as we've gone along. So that's good to know, too, and I think it's good for the public to know that.
And do you foresee that will be possible to do going forward?
I do, yes.
And can you speak to the independent, the financial independence from the DCIC, from PG&E, since you spoke of it?
Sure. The funding for the committee going forward, that's an important point. Traditionally, our funding comes, I'll say, through PG&E. PG&E provides the actual funds to us. We draw it down quarterly, but the funding comes from the PG&E ratepayers. It has been part of the PG&E general rate case. We're a small part of that rate case, but it does come from, it comes through PG&E, but not from PG&E. And in the future, as we move into this new regime, the funding will come from all the load-serving entities that are regulated by the Public Utilities Commission that benefit now under the arrangement for extended operations for the power plant to go forward. So the funding will still be coming through PG&E, but it will not be coming from PG&E. It will be coming from the entities that benefit from the Diablo Canyon extended operations, I'll say. So that it'll be coming from more entities than just the PG&E ratepayers. And any monies that we don't spend during the year, and there are years where we don't spend all our funding allocations, mm-hmm. and in that case, the money goes back to the ratepayers who provide our funding. We don't carry over any funding from year to year.
Good.
Yeah. And that's been our case right from the beginning. So
what happens if we have a study that is projected to exceed the budget for the year?
If we exceed our budget for the year, under the prior funding methodology, we started out the next year short. That money came out of the succeeding year. Under the new funding methodology, going forward this year and into the future, if we overspend at the end of the calendar year, that money will come back to the committee with a 10%, I'll say, surcharge on top of that. So we will be reimbursed for any monies that we expend in the future. That's a significant improvement in our funding situation. But I would point out it only comes back into the next calendar year.
But in essence, there is independence of the committee to identify issues that need attention and to spend that effort.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the funding is not dedicated to you. The members are wholly, have been and remain wholly in charge of their of the areas that you want to look into.
And PG&E has facilitated that independence and that functioning.
Yeah, they have, yes. Yeah. Okay, that's my discussion on funding. The next thing, we have two committee policies that are pending before us. One of them is an emergency response policy. We discussed that at the October meeting in some detail. We left it at that point that the committee should explore meeting with Cal OES, the state emergency services organization, and determine how we might either visit their facilities and possibly, I'll say, make them aware of our role and what we think we can bring and what we should bring into an emergency situation. And I've been working with Dr. Justin Cochran at the California Energy Commission on this, and recently he and I exchange communication, and Dr. Cochran suggests that the DCISC provide a list of questions to the Cal OES Radiological Protection Unit of the items that we would like to discuss in a remote meeting with the Radiological Protection Unit. They have some concerns over confidentiality in an emergency situation, which I think are certainly justified. So after this meeting, it would be good if we could do that in a fairly short order, and then there would be it's contemplated that there would be a remote meeting with the RPU, the Radiological Protection Unit for Cal OES, and the committee. We've also expressed some interest in making a visit to the state operation facilities, which are in Mather, California, I believe, near Sacramento. And Dr. Cochran has suggested to me that we pursue that opportunity with the governor's Senior Advisor for Energy Policy, and that's Ms. Christine Hironaka. Yep. And that would be part of our effort to close the loop on this. I don't know if you want to consider the emergency policy any further today. I'll let you speak to that.
Yeah, if I may make a couple of comments on
sure.
that.
Sure. Thank you.
When we were here in October, looked at the emergency policy, there were a series of two categories of changes to that policy that were outstanding. There were minor red lines to the policy that we had inserted into the document that PG&E had not yet accepted. And since our meeting in October, PG&E has accepted those red lines, so that issue has been closed. The second was a yellow highlighted phrase in the document, and that's still highlighted in the document that we had in the package today. Given the new information we gathered at Kendall Road and the ongoing discussions with the state, Dr. Mishkati has withdrawn his objection to that phrase and is now in agreement that that would be appropriate for the document as it stands now. So that document is clear of, I mean, it's basically all parties, PG&E and the committee have agreed to its word. However, it remains outstanding for our intent and advice we've gotten from several external organizations to contact OES and discuss our relationship with them. So we have a document that's ready to go. I think we probably would be wise to hold it as it is until we continue that effort, but there's certainly opportunity to do otherwise if you'd like.
I want to thank Mr. McWhorter for working very diligently and hard for many years on that document. He went through multiple versions and multiple drafts of that. My objection, as he correctly stated, that has been addressed by Dr. Justin Cochran. If he's online, I would like to thank him by providing me that option in lieu of that PG&E option. That door was closed, that we make an observation over there, God forbid, during an emergency at the OES, and opening up this alternative of the Government Emergency Services Office. And I think with the visit that we had to the Kendall Road and others, the combination of Dr. Cochran's suggestion, Kendall Road, and that, I'm willing to withdraw my objection to that emergency statement and don't want to be a troublemaker anymore. Thank you.
This makes sense to me also. And why don't we defer until we have also had the opportunity to share this with and coordinate with Cal OES as recommended. So the thing is, we have the procedure, so we will, if there was any need to for us to respond, I think we're prepared now to be able to do that. We would just follow this existing procedure. Also, another question is whether and how we should integrate this into our fact findings where we observe emergency response exercises. Should we be testing or developing, should we be practicing also?
I think we ought to keep our focus this year on the two newest members being able to give their full attention to observing the exercise as it stands and not to how we respond. I think that's far more important. And I think we're headed that direction. We can, it's something we, the consultants, can keep in mind while we're observing that exercise, but I wouldn't want to detract from the primary purpose.
That makes sense because, of course, there's no scenario where the DCISC is in the control room as the accident initiates, which is what happens in the training exercise, but that's what we do is we're in the simulator room at the very beginning. So we're observing what's actually happening.
I'm not sure if I would defer or maybe we're completely in agreement, but we're saying it differently. But I think that in observing the exercises, I would imagine that I'm observing in the capacity of if this were a real scenario, this would be me, a member of the committee, doing the same thing.
It would be. Not in the control room.
You would be arriving a lot later in the exercise.
Yeah, exactly. So when we're observing, we're actually seeing how it plays out.
So we're seeing, okay.
But yeah. It's not really, actually, the thing is that we, you know, we would actually be arriving towards the end of the exercise. Maybe at the end of the day, we travel to Kendall Road.
Right.
And arrive. Just to prove out how that would work. And, of course, the other thing is that we now have hard hats and vests that distinguish us so that people know who it is, who we are.
So is there any element of this exercise where PG&E or the county emergency services would want us to simulate our presence as the committee so that the exercise is completely simulating a real scenario?
The scenarios are restricted, and I'm a drill participant, so I'm precluded from knowing that information right now because I have to come in and react to it as it evolves.
Got it.
Karina's on that team as well. So we can discuss that at a fact-finding meeting without us in the room. Jordan Timon and Andy Warwick, who the committee have met with before, the director and the manager of emergency planning, they can discuss that with you.
Okay, that's really helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think another practical point is that for any member of the committee to arrive on site, the timing would be near when the exercise is being concluded anyhow. So but that said, if we can at least determine whether there may be some way that going to Kendall at the end of the exercise checking in the way that we would and gaining access, doing the set of things that we would do upon arriving during an actual emergency. That may be something we want to do as a part of observing an exercise.
So during the fact-finding, who should we connect with to discuss?
Jordan Timon and Andy Warwick. Mr. McWhirter is familiar with them. We just completed a fact-finding last month with them.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Excellent. Okay.
And then, Mr. Chair, one more.
So then I think on this one we don't have any actions to take, correct?
No. Not on the emergency response policy, no.
Okay.
That's the committee's...
I mean, we'll be doing a set of things, but we don't need to vote on anything.
The next policy that we have before you is the process map, which...
Microphone. Oh, but we have comment online.
Microphone.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, good. All right, let's keep going.
Okay, the next is also in your agenda packet is the process map policy that addresses, I'll say, the workflow for... committee recommendations, concerns, conclusions, and observations. These items, recommendations, concerns, and conclusions, are terms that are used in our annual report, and this policy provides a definition of those terms, and I did have some comment back from the members and consultants on this. I've made those, but Dr. Scarlett also had some comments that I believe she wanted to speak to in context of this policy. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I had comments and clarifications, I
Got
guess.
It. And in your packets for this meeting, I provided your revised draft.
So
it's not in there. It was in the package. You didn't. Yeah.
Okay. So I think it's...
Microphone.
Well, I was looking to get feedback from Naj and Per on the edits and comments that I left. So maybe...
And I believe they had to do with creating a process for public comment in addition to what is addressed in the policy that's in the...
So I can walk through them, I suppose. Would that be useful if I walk through them? Okay. And does the audience... Does the public have access to this?
They do not.
Okay, so I'll describe what this says. So this is a process map for recommendations, concerns, conclusions, and observations. These are terms that we use in our fact-finding reports and annual reports. And the document starts with definitions.
And then it follows with a page that describes the process. So I organize this content in a table that tries to follow the workflow of each of the terms that is being defined. So the what terms are being defined? Recommendations to PG&E, we're defining that term. Recommendation to DCISC, we're defining that term. Concern, significant conclusion, specific conclusions, and observation. And on the workflow, there are fact findings, there are public meetings, there's the open items list, there's a fact-finding report, an annual report, and then there's actions by the DCISC and actions by PG&E. So I try to follow each of those definitions through these workflows. I think that's the highlight of it.
I think that this is a very important and valuable set of definitions. I'm supportive of.
I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to look at your comments because I was out of country and I didn't read that. I just look at the hard copy of it, which was included in the package. They look reasonable to me. I haven't read that before, and my apology.
Yeah, you know, the value of having this rather than not having it is so high. I don't want to. I'm perfectly happy to go with and add in the additional edits, and furthermore, having a table is a very good idea.
Thank you. So maybe I can highlight a couple of questions I had posed. Is that okay?
Sure.
One question I had was whether we should have a workflow for public comments that we receive during public meetings or in emails.
My response to that would be that we already have that.
Okay, and where?
And I'm kind of frustrated by the time limits we're running up against here, because this is going to affect the open items list discussion as well.
Yes.
But I mean, basically, what we've done in reviewing the minutes, you see any public comments that are made that require action, you get bolded, they get included in the open items list. I mean, we have a whole history of actions that we have taken that have been initiated by public comments in this meeting. The SRT, that started with public comments. So,
I completely agree. I'm just wondering if we should capture this in the, because we're writing a policy that describes our process, and I feel like that is part of our process. So should we capture it?
Although to clarify, we receive public comments,
right?
But the reason that we take an action is because a member states, and so it's
the
bolded
true.
Text is
right.
What that member said in response to public comments. So I think that the idea that a member can during the course of the public meeting, direct us to take an action on something, including something that we should investigate in a fact finding. But that would be something that the member does very, very commonly. It is initiated because of something we learned from public comment.
So just responding to Rick's point about time for open site and list, which is really important to get to, is it, can we maybe approve as is and then issue another version of it when we're ready to make more edits?
Sure.
I'm happy with that.
It's a committee policy. It's you know, if we can adopt it with the changes with the table that you provided, Dr. Scarlett, and then if between now and the June meeting, if you want to revisit that, we can certainly do that.
Okay.
There's no problem.
Perfect.
Doing that. Yeah.
So the only question marks I had in my table were, for concerns, do they show, they are documented in fact-finding reports, question mark? It just wasn't clear from the policy.
Yes. They'd be listed just as a recommendation within the fact-finding report.
They would not be
although concerns generally appear in context of the annual report.
Yeah, what the process currently.
They don't appear in the fact-finding reports.
I think we've used them in the fact-finding reports.
What regard?
Well,
what are you thinking? I'm not sure if I'll...
As opposed to recommend... Because, for example, my memory is that we ended up having a formal concern around plant staffing. And the reason we made it a concern rather than a recommendation
was that we also assessed that PG&E had the equivalent concern as working proactively. So we didn't need to recommend that they do anything because we thought that what they were doing was that they were already doing the correct set of things.
Yeah.
However, we wanted to document that it was an important issue so that we would be tracking it too. But yeah, that may be superseded now that we do recommendations to DCISC.
I think it is somewhere.
Our recommendation is to follow something. Is that?
I think another avenue we've used for concerns too is when we do the annual report, the consultants go and go through all the fact-finding reports and kind of slice and dice them by category, such as spent fuel management.
Yeah.
We'll have a section in section 3 where we summarize all of our findings on spent fuel management for the last year with their fact-finding reports, and we have had concerns roll out of that into concerns stated in the executive summary of the annual report.
Correct. That's generally how the concerns emerge.
That makes sense. Okay.
So, you know, we haven't had a concern section in the annual report of a month fact-finding report like we have recommendations or conclusions, but we have had concerns roll out of an annual report, and I think it's reflective of the fact that a lot of our reports, we see things and we see opportunities that we might be concerned about, but we don't have specific recommendations, but we put a couple of fact-finding reports together and then all of a sudden we do have a concern. It's kind of our own trending mechanism in some ways.
That's great. Yeah. So this was great to clarify. I'm glad we had a discussion about this. And then, so do concerns show up on open items list or no, they don't?
No, I mean, there's not a separate category.
That's correct. Okay, makes sense.
I mean, and that's a question. I mean, if it is a concern, is it an open item?
Yeah.
If you're not expecting future action or response, then it's not an open item.
Right, okay, yeah. So that's clear. And then the last question I had here was, are they discussed at public meetings in the context of the annual report review and approval? Yes. Concerns are discussed.
Yeah, they would.
Okay. And observations are observations documented in annual reports, or are these just fact finding things?
They have never been documented in the annual report. They're a new, an emerging element of our review, I would say, and they would be documented. I would assume in fact findings. Maybe Dr. Mascotti could speak to observations because I think it was his suggestion that we add those.
Yeah, I learned that term by the BP Deepwater Horizon Committee of National Academy of Engineering. There were some things that were not, because when you make a recommendation, they said that it has to be aligned one by one with one of the findings. And every finding should be as having one or several recommendations associated with that. Observation was a little bit, what I say, lower version of it. It was an observation, almost like a finding, but we don't have necessarily a recommendation for that. That was something we learned in that report of National Academy, and it was well received by the public and by the Congress, and also by New York Times editorial writer, that it was a good report. And because it really separates, findings are very solid thing that we say that this was a major issue, and then there could be several recommendations to address them. Observation is a little bit lower version, and so it's there, and there may not be necessarily a recommendation associated with that.
So they don't show up on open items list and they're not necessarily discussed at the public meeting?
Sorry?
They don't show up on the open items list and they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily discussed at the public meeting.
I haven't had a chance to take the observation to the annual report on that. But I don't know, maybe we had had one observation.
My microphone. Now is your microphone? Is it on?
Sorry. I don't remember that that when I made that observation or made that suggestion, to what extent, to about what issue was it, and was it basically carried all the way to annual report or not. But this was something that we were discussing, and it was not, again, at the level of finding, but it was important to note it. This is basically noting something which is for the public to know, and maybe we will revisit that. It wasn't a finding or a conclusion. Because in the fact-finding report, we have write-ups and then we have some conclusion and recommendation to DCISC and recommendation to PG&E. Am I right?
Okay.
Conclusion and then some recommendation.
Yes.
This was not at that level. But it concerned, or for lack of a better term, it captured the attention of the member and the consultant. This gives, speaking of flexibility, this gives some flexibility if I see something, for example, that in my judgment and in my perception is noteworthy, state that. But it may not be finding and requires a conclusion and a recommendation.
PG&E?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just as the organization that will react to this, what I want to be sure is that we understand how you've level set this, maybe akin to our regulatory rubric, like this is equivalent to a non-cited violation or something. Because what I don't want to be is in 3 years saying, we had 62 observations and PG&E responded to 4 of them. I don't think that would serve this process well. So I hope you adopt something today and amend it. That's fine with us, but I just want to know what the expected reaction is and then how we document those. We don't want the committee's efforts on an observation to go unnoticed, but I don't know how to fit them in our process right yet. So I just want to point that out because ultimately whatever you conclude is going to come to us in some way and there's going to be a reaction. So I need to know what the reaction you're expecting is.
Again, if you have that issue, Mr. Jones, with the observation, then we can eliminate that, but then it restricts me, at least as a member, that I need to elevate that to the level of finding and then include that in conclusions.
So I think what we have at the moment in the workflow for the PG&E column is only recommendation to PG&E. And so PG&E needs to respond to the recommendations. And then under concern, sometimes PG&E will share issues or questions with DCISC. And so these are the only explicit interactions of PG&E with this workflow.
Yeah, my point is I just don't want to lose sight of the value of the observation, and I appreciate the flexibility in the tool. I just want to know what the expectation is from the utility back to the committee when an observation is shared.
So I think none as far as we've described it here.
Yeah, they would be conveyed in the fact-finding reports, but you guys don't necessarily respond to all our fact-finding reports.
All right, thank you for the clarification.
You respond to our annual report, which is essentially a compilation of our fact-finding reports.
Got it. Thank you.
Very good. So I do note that we are now pressed for time.
Yeah, and let me just hit the two real quick things. We have two agreements now for additional consulting services agreements, and those have been... We were directed to do this at the last meeting, and we have entered into those agreements with Mr. Richard St. Ange and Dr. G. Kenneth Kovas. And it would be appropriate at this time for the committee, by direction, I'll say, to ratify those agreements.
And can you restate their scope?
That's in the agreement there. Both agreements are in the packet under the gray levels. If you like, I can read them both.
Please.
This is for Mr. St. Ange to participate in technical programmatic reviews of safety of Diablo Canyon Power Plant nuclear operations regarding matters in connection with plant decommissioning and spent nuclear fuel storage in certain DCISC public meetings and the development of DCISC fact-finding reports and annual reports concerning matters in which the consultant participated. Provide support to the committee as requested by committee members. Those tasks include, but are not limited to, reviewing committee, PG&E, and documents from other sources as a basis for recommending potential issues or concerns that the committee may wish to pursue, participating in committee fact-finding visits and tours of Diablo Canyon Power Plant, helping to identify additional supporting specialists and developing background material on specific issues and reviewing, preparing, and presenting reports and public presentations concerning these activities. That's essentially the working scope for Mr. St. Ange and for Dr. Kovas. The scope of services includes participation in technical and programmatic reviews of the safety of Diablo Canyon Power Plant nuclear operations regarding matters in connection with human factors, safety culture, and management systems in certain DCIC public meetings and in the development of DCIC fact-finding reports and annual reports concerning matters in which the consultant participated. Same, I'm not going to repeat all this again because the rest is the same as Dr. as Mr. St. Ange. So those are the scopes of service for these two consultants.
And the timeline is a year or multiple years? Or
the agreements are open-ended.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Very good. So I think that we've had the previous discussion, the previous public meeting, about engaging services from these two consultants, and there's a consensus. These agreements are in place, so I think it's just a formality for us to do the approval.
That's correct. You could just probably a motion would be appropriate to ratify both agreements.
So I move to ratify both agreements.
I second it.
I think formally this preceded me, so I should probably abstain. Not that I have any objection, but formally.
That's fine. In that case, then we can vote. Vote aye.
Aye.
Perfect.
And one objection. And the last thing I'll report is yesterday I was informed that we have received from PG&E the annual compensation letter for the members' compensation. So I've not had a chance to distribute that to you yet because my internet is down. But after the meeting, I will distribute it to you. And we are required by the terms of the charter to provide PG&E feedback as to the compensation for the members going forward.
So. Yes, and in that case, we believe that we should be benchmarked with the NSOC. That's what we want to confirm is that the rates are consistent with PG&E's internal.
And I know our time is very short for the open items, so I apologize for having taken this time.
And so let's plan to move expeditiously through open items. Rick, are you going to cover these or? Perfect.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And let's try to be expeditious. We do need to finish these within the next half hour.
Okay. Does everybody have a copy of open items list in front of them? I'll go page by page. Noting first that there's a little bit of format change. Anything that's changed from the last version of this that was talked about at the October public meeting should be in standard red lines with regards to everything in red has changed, and strikeouts are shown in line through. Yellow are items that Lisa and I have looked at and consider that are on the horizon for action between now and the June public meeting. There are four categories to this. I'll start by going through what I call category one, the routine, which is the first seven or so pages. Any comments on page one?
Rick, is there a heading that says routine or no?
I'm sorry, it's what?
Is there a heading that says routine or no? That's just your.
It's just the open, it's just called open items.
It's just called, okay.
That's the heading. Page two, page three, page four, page five, the item at the top, SF1, we talked about, and I've made a note that we're going to make that a part of the May 25 fact-finding meeting.
Mm-hmm. That's the next action, Rick, May 25?
Yeah. Correct.
That's correct.
Are we going to maintain the March?
I think May and March. Different scope.
Yeah, different scope. Okay,
Yes, that's
we're
true.
We're covering very different sets of phenomenology questions.
And that's item SF1?
Correct.
Okay.
So that would be covered in March and May 26. Any other comments on 5?
The only comment I have is SF8. Do we need to amend that item at all based upon the questions we still have pending regarding the stress corrosion cracking on the multipurpose canisters?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure what the path
actually,
forward on that is.
Actually, the scope in May overlaps this generically. So we might as well put down that we're covering this scope as a part of the May.
May fact finding.
Yeah, because this is actually the scope, and the fact that that's not out yet, we're still going to cover it because of the concerns being raised by members of the public.
Okay.
And
I thought SF8 was the EPRI study, and SF9 was more of the questions.
The specific one is really what are the dose consequences of having stress corrosion cracking in a canister, and that actually in many respects would be more SF8, but we'll get the details of that worked out with the actual fact finding in terms of providing both the read ahead material but also the questions to cover.
Okay. I can add some words to SF8 to make it more general on dose consequences to include the EPRI study but not be solely
exactly
that.
That's a good idea. Thank you, Rick.
So I think SF9 would partly fall under March as well.
Exactly.
So
yeah, for sure.
So next action on both SF8 and 9 is 525 fact finding.
320.
Both. Yeah, we'll cover this in both the March and in the May. But the specific phenomenology and scope will be different between those. Because I think one is more associated with the phenomena that drives stress corrosion cracking to occur, the aging, and then the other is what is the consequence if you do get stress corrosion crack.
Okay,
so I've got for SF8 May 25 and for SF9 March of 25.
And SF7?
Deferred because Class C waste is generated primarily during decommissioning activities when they segment the reactor internals.
Okay.
Yeah,
so that's more of a decommissioning phase. So we just keep it but it's not.
Can we make a note to reserve for decommissioning activities? Because it's going to remain open for a while. Can we comment it?
Well, actually, maybe we could just clarify plans for storage of greater than Class C waste, comma, including greater than Class C waste generated during decommissioning operations. Because you get about two canisters full from when you segment the reactor internals, the core barrel and stuff.
Okay.
Usually it takes a couple for that purpose.
Okay.
So next action
okay,
on
we're getting really close. Okay,
I'm a little confused. Okay.
Ten. Oh, yes. In that case, yeah, 10. Wow, that's.
I'm sorry. What?
Oh, this is 2 units. That's right. I was benchmarking off of Main Yankee, which I think was 2 or 3.
Okay. I'm a little confused on next actions.
I'm lost in this discussion too. We're talking about SF7, right?
Yeah, and there's nothing. It's basically there's no urgency. So
this is for storage of Class C waste generated during decommissioning operations.
Yeah,
it's going to stay TBD, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, right. I thought there was a date thrown out. That's
no date.
Okay.
Just that it helps people understand immediately why it's TBD.
Gotcha.
Okay. Can we just go over next actions? SF1 next action 526 fact finding.
And 326.
Well, then next action would be 326.
Yes.
Well, we sometimes list multiples.
Yeah. Okay. I think we've got
three.
Okay. And the same for SF8 and SF9, 326 and 526.
No, SF9 is 326. SF8 is
526.
526,
yeah.
SF8 is 526. Okay.
And
SF9 is 326.
And Rick is going to update the language on SF8 to make it a bit more general.
Right, but what happens after the meeting, generally Lisa and Rick and I will get together and we will go through the open items list and compare our notes.
Perfect.
So it's important that we try to be accurate.
Okay, any other comments on page 5?
Six.
Page 6. There's a new item, LD7, that's been added here as a result of comments from the October public meeting. It was actually talked about being put elsewhere, but I think it goes into learning programs more appropriate than the other category, which I can't remember.
Okay.
Also trying to get Dr. Mishkati and Dr. Scalat to observe as much operator training as, or serve operator training as soon as possible, hopefully the simulator sometime. So we're trying to include that in the fact-finding meeting for Dr. Mishkati in April. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Scarlatt is going to talk about training in general in March.
Thank you. That was very prudent.
Good. Okay, anything else on 6, not 7?
So for NR 5, well, do you think it will be feasible to have a presentation from OIG at the June public meeting?
Well, okay, so I can add to NR 6, which is the OIG thing. 6:26 p.m.
Yes.
Okay.
But I think it's also tied to NR 5. Do we have an NRC talk?
The NRC Region 4 is prepared to present a discussion at the June meeting.
Okay, perfect. So both NR5 and NR6 will be discussed at the June meeting. Great.
Yes, my understanding, we're looking at potentially two separate presentations.
Okay.
One from Region 4 on what they think will be the changes to the inspection program, and one for the OIG for your interest.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, actually, those I think have to be separate presentations.
I think so. I
mean, they're completely separate. Yeah, because no, OIG can't, they can't speak for the other.
Unless they find something wrong with it.
Well, okay. At any rate, it'll be two separate presentations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Anything else on 6? Not on to 7. I'll just say in 01, both Dr. Mishkati and Dr. Scalat and the rest of us agree that the more we can observe work in progress, the better. So we continue to try to get opportunities to do that. And that includes observing operators in the field or maintenance techs primarily.
Yep.
Okay.
So EMB 6, on page 7, sorry, EMB 6, that's partly part of March fact-finding as well?
No, that is specific to information in the license renewal application that might affect embrittlement currently. And we reviewed the last... The NRC safety evaluation report that came out in June of 25 has been the information on embrittlement that was in that document was reviewed by Dr. Kirk. He provided a letter. It did not, he had some questions. They were resolved, but it did not change the conclusions of his analysis. That's the letter dated 1/13/26 that we received. So there is currently no new information to be reviewed out of the licensing process relative to embrittlement.
I see. So then Capsule B, we have it listed for the July fact finding, but there might be a special.
That's probably going to accelerate.
Yeah.
We talked about that. So EMB3, let's call it May 26.
Okay.
And it's indirectly part of my March work scope so that I can come up to speed on all of those conversations. I don't know how we document that. It's more of an onboarding question for me.
Yeah, that's... I mean, we talked about it in our December 3rd fact-finding meeting with PG&E. I think if you spend time on it in March, you're going to hear a lot of the same stuff from PG&E with regards to the status of the current analysis. Maybe... What we need to do is arrange for you to get with Mark Kirk and go through some of his past analysis and come up to speed.
That makes sense, yeah.
And I'll take the lead on trying to get that together as I'm coordinating with Mark Kirk his review in May.
Thank you very much. That would be great. Okay. And I think if we could do that before my March fact-finding, that would be most useful in my timing.
Okay.
That's all I had on page 7.
Okay. All right. Shifting gears on page 8 is items out of the public meeting. This is the items that result from the process I described, where the minutes, Bob highlights anything that's potentially an action item, and then I pull those highlighted statements pretty much verbatim into this document as an action item to be considered. A lot of them, by nature, get closed because we take action by the time before the next public meeting, so but we document the fact that it was noted, it was looked at, and it was closed. The first one, we talked about the fact we have a tour during this meeting. I think I have proposed closures here.
Yes.
If you have any questions about that, please let me know.
No, I think it's reasonable to close this, and what we're doing is we're scheduling around potential simulator availability to maintain the option of conducting additional public meetings, or public tours.
I'll just take the opportunity to say I don't think we'll have any time available to do a tour in June.
Right.
We have a lot of stuff piled up for the June public meetings.
Let's see how this one goes, and then in June we can make decisions. I don't think we need to do it with every public meeting.
Okay.
Are we, if we're going to have a tour in June, we need to plan.
Exactly. I think the answer is no.
Okay.
We got too much scope to cover.
I agree.
In the last pages, the last couple of pages. Okay. Any other comments on page 8? Not page 9. These are starting middle of the page are action items from the October public meeting. You can see a lot of them were already taken, action was already taken on. Page 10.
Actually, going back to page 9, mm-hmm. like item 34, 36, have we taken care of those? And those, do we need to close them? 36 doesn't have anything on it. Which I think we've resolved that as of this meeting.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, so why don't we put 226 and close?
For both of those?
Yeah, and then process, we've accepted the process map?
We have, yes.
Yeah, so then that's closed too. We've got that.
Okay, got it. All right, page 10.
What's the status of 5?
Number 5, yep.
I think we have a follow-up at the March fact finding, which has to do with training, impact of AI on training. I think that's possibly March. We could list it as March fact.
Do we have a general item on AI? Someplace back there, right?
We do.
So can we flow these things to that general item?
We can. I just wanted to make sure that was an apples-to-apples closure. I think that's why I didn't propose this.
Yeah, okay.
Because Dr. Gill's concern were kind of different from what we would normally approach, but I think we use her concerns to educate our approach to AI. We have a recommendation to the committee that we'll cross paths with here, one of the recommendations that starts with D on the topic of AI, and I would close it to that one. I'd have to go look at the number, but so would you be okay with closing that one to the recommendation on AI, to the committee recommendation?
Well,
on
AI? But I'm looking for where we're covering AI currently.
Okay,
and because it's much broader than just training,
so
right? So
that would be on page 13, the third item down from the top.
Because the application of AI tools has significant potential to change and improve DCPP's operational safety, we should review this topic frequently.
Okay. But then do we need something on AI in the open items list? Does it deserve to be its own category?
I think
it was one.
That's the thing. So I was going back because we have
okay. So
LD10.
It's there's already one on page 2,
yeah,
the bottom PI3. That's probably the correct one to close it to. Well.
Page two.
Page two, which one was
PI3
the?
PI3 on the bottom.
PI3.
Oh, PI3. Oh, yes. Okay, that's fine. So, yeah, I would say that this is the place where generally we could close items that relate to artificial intelligence, too.
Okay.
But then we need to make sure that I think this one fits. Yeah, so we can close to PI3.
All right, what about number six? Would you do the same?
Actually, I'm not sure if PI3 includes all of what...
Yeah.
I lost the page. Sorry, we were on page 10, right? What number 5 referred to.
I would.
Because, okay, so number 5 was track how Neutron search is being used and if any documents are in its operation in order to convey that information and any safety concerns to the developers of the model. So this was a bit more specific.
Yeah, in that case, then, I think we do want to have a fact-finding, which is an update on Atomic Canyon, that would cover the scope.
We had one. Actually, we could close it because we had one in December.
But did we cover this specific?
We covered this specific in December.
Perfect.
In my fact-finding.
Yeah. So then this one can close.
But we concluded that it should be a recurring check-in.
Yeah, and so maybe we can add some language to PI3 about the foundation models.
Yeah, I think that'd be a
foundation
good way to
models
do it.
Training, and then also there's NRC has a strategic plan for implementation of AI in their inspection planning.
Yeah, I think those all need to be captured in PI3.
Okay, so NRC training,
so
foundational models.
Yeah.
Neutron.
Okay, so yeah, let's
Rick,
capture those things in three.
You have all the notes you need for that to make that edit.
I hope so. It's a little. I think the focus is. We need to add something to PI3 that focuses on the risks.
Yeah.
And we're trying to articulate how we follow up to make sure the risks are appropriately understood.
We're going to be following this frequently, so I think we don't have to have perfect language for that item because we'll be updating it anyhow.
So rapidly. Why don't we just remove the possible applications? That way it's broad. Can we do that?
Remove what? Sorry.
Whatever simplest.
Remove the from where PI3
mm-hmm.
second sentence says possible applications. Delete that part. So it just remains as a general statement. The PI3 would become because the application of AI has significant potential to change and improve operational safety. DCIC should review this topic frequently. Period. End of recommendation.
Yeah. So this is an example of an issue that's complicated by having recommendations in addition to open items. So if you look at the top of page 13, line 3, we have a recommendation that the committee should maintain a list of potential future artificial intelligence applications that could enhance safety.
You know, the key thing is I'm also looking at the time, and we could probably spend another hour on specifically on AI. We know that we're going to be covering it carefully, so I'm not so concerned about getting precise, exact language on PI3 as much as I am on making sure we can get through the rest of these items.
So can we just delete that sentence and then it's done?
Yeah, I think Rick's point about, I think we need to augment it with a little bit more around risk. Because this ties to the recommendation, this language.
And right. So if I can articulate, we're talking about on page 10, items 5 and 6. I should have tried to capture
if you could distill,
the risk of those into
PI3. If you could distill that into like one or two sentences to be added to PI3.
Maybe we don't have time, so 5 and 6 just need to be tabled to public meeting for June. Don't have time to discuss it.
Just leave them blank like they were. And we'll talk about it at the next meeting.
We're going to talk about AI every week.
So just leave them blank then. We'll talk about it in the next meeting.
All right, and I will add some words to PI3.
Very good. Okay, that sounds good. All right.
We were on page 10.
It looks like everything on 10 closes, okay. Which I agree with. Then we go to 11, maybe.
Okay. Number 18 down there is the one that created the new LD7 item.
Mm-hmm.
LD7. Okay, sure.
Okay. Let me see. Okay. So 17 is another AI one just to keep open, I think, and table. But then if we go to 14, we review 5059 routinely, right? Uh-huh. So can we just close to whatever that is?
To review as part of next 5059 review.
Okay, because
I don't think we would capture his concern without being reminded of it.
That's fine. Okay, that's good.
Okay. Page 12.
I had a question on 19.
Sorry?
19.
Okay.
What's the status? Do we close it?
I mean, I think this fits into our conversation about public outreach that's ongoing. I don't have anything to close that to that I know we're doing.
I do have some questions around public outreach, but I don't know when I bring those up. Do I bring them up now?
Why don't we cover that next public meeting?
Okay. Does that preclude me from having work scope in that area?
No, you can do anything you want with Pathfinder.
Okay. Excellent. So we keep it open and we'll discuss it in this public meeting.
Okay.
Public comment?
Yes. I want to make a public comment. Just a little update on page 11, item 19. On February 18th, Assemblymember Josh Hoover expressed interest in sponsoring CGNP's Diablo Canyon extension legislation. We submitted a draft to Legislative Council on January 23rd, 2026. So just a little status update there.
Thank you. Okay, page 12.
I mean, I think 22 and 23 are ongoing efforts and stay open.
Okay. Oh, yes, they are. Those will get worked on during this next period, so yes.
Okay, so that takes us to the third section of the open items list, which is recommendations to the committee. There are first comment I would make on line 4, where we talked about employee safety culture. I proposed that to be closed in my fact-finding report. We changed that to open, so I will leave that open to be followed up at the April fact-finding meeting. First red line item is planned for the March 26th fact-finding meeting, I believe. Is that right, Lisa? Or do we need to do that another time? I can't remember.
3.1, you mean 20?
On the completion time question?
Yes.
Yes. I'm okay. Starting to know it's on the agenda for now, right?
Okay.
Yeah, that would be. Same with the next one, March.
The next one should be March as well?
3.5 is March.
Okay.
3.8, I don't know if we'll fit it in March.
Right, and we think we just leave that one open. That's probably a longer term.
Okay.
And then I have for the three lines from the bottom, the D12, 225, 311. Are you guys going to look at chemistry and the permit in March?
I think so.
Okay.
If PG&E can schedule it, that would be a good one.
Yeah, right now it's on the list.
Okay. All right, we'll just leave it that.
Due to length, right now it's on the list.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Any other actions on 13?
Nope, and just note there is a closure proposed at the bottom, kind of returning that to our routine item.
Yep.
All right, page 14.
Down near the bottom, 3.1, I think we resolved that today. And we sent in the fact-finding report to CPSC, okay. So I think we can close that one.
Okay, that's good. The second one from the top, the cause evaluation for the feed water heat exchanger failure. I've tentatively put in April 26th for Naj and I to look at that if that is completed. No. Hopefully it will be by then.
Yeah, I think that's good. That's okay. Perfect. And also with the recommendation and PG&E's specific plans to procure replacement feed water heaters, I think all of these things will end up being resolved in terms of a path that maintains reliability.
Right.
Good.
And you can also see here, this is part of our long list of things for the June public meeting.
Good. Okay.
Okay.
15?
Moving on to 15, these are recommendations to PG&E. We've got the one that's being closed on the auxiliary saltwater system. Electronic procedures had the for you for May, Dr. Peterson. Capsule Bravo, the one at the top, we'll move that. That should move to May 26th. Fact-finding, sorry?
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. The fourth one down, the snow committee. Dr. Muscati, I think you had a question.
Yeah, I had that meeting with the snow committee in August of last year, and we passed this recommendation in our October meeting, which was in the fact-finding meeting about PG&E should support and facilitate a regular meeting in person on that with the DCIC and designated member of the SNOW committee. What is the status of that? I'm talking about page 15, P825FF3.1, the regular meeting with the SNOW committee.
Have you gotten more input from PG&E, or have we gotten any more input from PG&E or SNOW on?
No, we haven't resolved this yet. It's open up for us.
And when? What's the next step in closing that?
We'll have it closed out by April 2nd.
Amazing. Thank you.
Okay.
April 2nd.
April 2nd.
Very specific.
Very good.
April
Thank
2nd
you.
And 8:52 and 32 seconds.
I just have a habit of not making things due on April 1st. It's just kind
of wrong, so. Fair enough. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Jones, you said that you will tell us by April about the status of this recommendation?
Correct.
Thank you.
It's open currently.
Thank
Very
you.
Good. Okay.
Okay. I think the ones that are open here stay. They're new. They just stay open until we find the appropriate opportunity to follow up. And we get a chance for PG&E to respond.
Perfect.
Moving to the SRT recommendations. The action was here at February 26. We got a commitment from PG&E to come back and talk about these again at June 26 public meeting. So I think all these move to the next action at June 26 public meeting.
I think that what we've committed to is a long-term effort over the next few years to monitor this. So my recommendation would be that we actually transfer this to become a item under SC, where we will be routinely reviewing the PG&E's work that relate to responding to the recommendations, but that we may even be able to close the recommendations. We can go back and reference them. But what we've done is we've accepted PG&E's response to those recommendations. So now we're just going to monitor how PG&E, what they actually do. And this will be with the support from Dr. Tom Jordan.
Okay, so I like that idea. Page 5, where the SCs are listed.
Yeah.
We could put it, we're talking about, I think what you're proposing is a single new item to follow up on all nine recommendations.
Yes.
And their follow-up in the future.
Yeah, and that way we can sort of bend them all together and be following them in addition to the independent peer review panel, which will also follow. And I do think that it would be good for us to ask Dr. Jordan to also help us with our monitoring of the IPRP.
That's exactly.
And that's it's a good point. SC14 is our one about monitoring the IPRP.
Mm-hmm.
We learned in this meeting that there's a new report out there that we should review.
Right. So why don't we say the next we're going to do both. We should do both of these at the June public meeting.
Yes.
And then we'll continue to follow them subsequently. But the next one, actually, the next one for IPRP should be the 6/26 p.m. And then we'll add a new item, I assume, SC716.
And also specifically SRT9, I think, was going to have an update at the June public meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Do we update that on page 16 or on page 5?
I think that because this new item, SC16, will be reported on at the public meeting.
Oh, I see.
It captures it.
Yeah, I would probably include in the wording of the item to follow up on SRT recommendations 1 through 9. If in the future we decide one of those is closed, we just say, 1 through 4, or just note that 5's been closed or something like that. We
Perfect.
Can keep track of them all under 1.
Okay.
At least for now, until it becomes too complicated.
Yep.
Perfect.
That will help eliminate 9 items out of the
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. Because this is getting to be increasingly complex in terms of sort of the number of things we're tracking. So being able to roll them together.
Yeah, I would like at some point in the future to talk about the complexity of this and how to have some suggestions on how to deal with that. But we're out of time to do that with this meeting.
Very good. Okay, so I think we've completed our review. Do we have anything else? Because we're very tight for time.
I understand. So for the public engagement, I will work with Lisa and Ken Coves to sort of delve into this question that I have around public engagement and emergency preparedness communication. I just want to make sure that our expertise is not in the area of public engagement, so I'd like to be able to engage other experts in that area. Do I have to get permission for those resources to be available to me? Or can I proceed?
I think that's an administrative matter that can be addressed by email. Is that correct, Bob?
Yes, I think we could. Yeah.
Okay, so then let's plan that we'll address those questions by email as an administrative matter.
This is public engagement?
Yeah, related to public engagement. That's good. Okay, so then do we need to take any action with respect to the open items list? At this point, we've provided the feedback. We had some public comment on the open items list during the period, but I do need to ask, is there any additional public comment related to the open items list?
Right. I have one hand raised online from Robert Bundens.
Okay, yes, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, Perry, I was going to make this comment before you just made it. You want to add another one to SC about the implications of following the SRT and its implications. And I want to suggest that you change the technical scope of that as follows. Let me read what my suggestion would be. This would be a new SC. Review the impact of new seismic hazard information on the understanding of overall seismic safety. The reason I'm saying that is that goes beyond just reviewing the understanding of seismic hazard. What I want you to do is to add an open item list item called Review the Impact of New Seismic Hazard Information on the Understanding of Overall Seismic Safety. Now, that means, if you don't mind my saying, that let's suppose 2 years from now or something like that, we have a different understanding of the hazard. The hazard has changed. Our understanding of the hazard has changed. Or maybe it's 3 years from now. Well, to understand the implication on safety, you have to understand the implication on whether or not specific structures or components have a seismic fragility that will be affected by this new hazard information. And by the way, maybe it's better or maybe it's worse. I don't know which, but at least there's some understanding, which you can only get by going to the seismic PRA and then asking whether the hazard, new changed hazard, has an effect on the response of different structures and components within the structure of the seismic PRA. So that's my suggestion. Maybe I ought to change it as follows. Review the impact of new seismic hazard information on the understanding of overall seismic safety through the seismic PRA. Okay? And that broadens this open item from just understanding the hazard to understanding its impact.
So I would note that Bob is correct. That is, we don't actually under seismic, tsunami, and other external events take it to the question of seismic safety.
And the sensitivity analysis does not include that?
Well, it should be. I mean, the fragility analysis and the response of the plant to the seismic inputs is important. And it's not actually explicitly called out here.
Is it not in SRT-9? Bob, does SRT-9 cover what you're saying?
Which one?
The sensitivity analysis recommendation.
No, it doesn't, because the SRT is focused purely on seismic hazard. It's not on the risk, because the hazard depends on how the plant responds, and we don't have an item. Given that we are now out of time, what I would recommend is that let's add an additional item under SC, which is the overall seismic safety.
And all right,
that would include the plant response, and it also envelopes the use of flex to mitigate consequences of failures.
I think it makes sense, because in the charter of SRT, we said SRT will submit its report to us, and then based on that report, we will take this step. That is basically referring to the charter of SRT. We say SRT is not looking at the impact of that on the plant components. That the second step, that the committee will decide what to do with the SRT report. Yeah. I think it's consistent with the SRT's charter.
Now, it might overlap to some degree the PRA risk assessment in terms of seismic. And I'm looking at our risk assessment management. Yeah, see, the thing is that we actually explicitly say review the overall non-seismic PRA. We don't have a place where we're actually looking. Yeah, so I would say adding a seismic safety item, and we can Rick, you can go back and figure out how to do that, is important, because we're not covering it under the overall risk assessment. It's actually specifically excluded from the PRA program.
And specifically interfaced with the sensitivity analysis results.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so then I think it's good. Bob, we'll take your advice to add another item.
I've got more.
Unfortunately, Bob, we're
no, at just the end one of the more thing. It takes 10 seconds. Go back to page 16 where you review systems. You reviewed DC power 4 years ago, and I just want to recommend that you put DC power back on your list to review sometime soon. The last time we reviewed it, I was there, and I suggest that you add that to it. That's a 10-second one. DC power.
Got it.
March 2022.
Okay.
I'm done.
Very good.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Okay. We have run out the clock. So what I can note is that we're very, very excited to be hosting our first public tour of the Diablo Canyon plant since before the pandemic. And that we will be leaving from here, I believe, at 12:30.
Roughly.
Oh, no. We'll be doing starting presentations, other things, around 12:30. So I'm going to be concluding this part of our public meeting I usually want to thank our PG&E staff and also AGP and all the other people that helped to support us in hosting this meeting. We're going to be going to grab a bite to eat, and then we'll be back again for the meeting. And we're really looking forward to this opportunity to travel with members of the public and to visit the Diablo Canyon plant. It's been some time since we were previously able to do that. Do we have any additional closing remarks or things that we need to do? Okay, so then we will be transitioning the public meeting to this public tour section. All the members are attending because we will have the public with us. So we'll be in compliance with the Bagley Clean. With that, let me go ahead and close part of our 113th Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you.